It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Jason Snell from Six Colors, Ben Johnson from Codebreaker, Sam Moshkovich from Ars Technica, and lots to talk about. Apple's earnings, the call once again to decrypt smartphones for law enforcement, and the addictiveness of social media. Plus, should you be polite to Amazon's Echo or not? It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 640, recorded Sunday, November 12th, 2017. Stand clear of the closing doors. This Week in Tech is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to ring.com/twit and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. And by WordPress. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off your brand new website today at wordpress.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com/twit to save 20% off any order. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with the brightest, funnest people in tech and talk about the week's tech news. It's kind of my therapy every week. I get to hash it out with people smarter than I, like Ben Johnson from Codebreaker. Hello, Ben.
How are you, sir? It's good to be back on the bridge with you, Captain.
I didn't hope you don't mind, but I put my Webby right in front of your screen.
How dare you? How dare you?
We were in a race.
I don't have mine. I gave mine to my producer.
Oh, you're so generous.
I got a generous heart, but that's beautiful. Sweet. It looks beautiful, man.
Now
it
looks beautiful. I'm feeling guilty.
Looks good on.
Wait a minute, you got one, didn't you, Carson? We bought an extra one for you. Okay. It's a spring. Look at that. So we're both nominated in the same category, but we both won, which is awesome. Ben's,
that's the best. Everybody gets one.
Everybody gets a prize. Yeah. We got the participation prize for Tech Podcasts. Ben and TWiT were actually, it was Triangulation, our interview show. We're in a heated vote battle for the People's Choice back and forth. You finally took the prize by a handful, I think, of votes. I think it was pretty close at the end. I don't know.
It was pretty close. Yeah. If the Russians had gotten involved, who knows?
Imagine. Who knows? Putin would have won. But we got ours because the committee felt bad. They gave us one. So that worked out okay. Also here from
Six. The judge's prize.
The judge's prize.
Well,
I was one of the judges, so. I was one of the judges, but I forgot to vote. I couldn't have voted on this one anyway, but I forgot. I like missed the deadline and I never voted on anything. They're not going to invite me back. Jason Snell is here, sixcolors.com.
Hey, Leo, it's good to be here.
Normally, you'd be in studio, but we decided that in the interest of parody that you should be like Zod frozen inside a monitor for this show.
Yeah, I'm in the Phantom Zone right now. Yes. And we get a little chummy when it's just the two of us live and everybody else is on a monitor. And then you just pay attention to me. And that's not fair.
We forget everybody. But not this time. You're all Zod this time. Joining us right now, Milady Sam Moshkovich. He is at Ars Technica, where he's a tech culture editor. And I'm amazed we could pry you away from Call of Duty World War II on your Scorpio.
My Scorpio, yeah. We don't call it Xbox One X over here at Moshkovich headquarters.
What do you call it?
The big box that's maybe costs a little too much, but is totally solid.
The Xbox One 10. Using the Apple.
iPhone. I got the iPhone X and the Xbox 10.
That's very confusing.
I just want everyone to be mad all at once.
Very confusing. How do you like the... I literally can't stop playing
on it. It's because I have a 4K HDR TV and it just looks beautiful.
Oh, I can go on and on about Xbox One X. I think it's pretty tremendous, especially for $500.
Well, it is expensive, I admit. But you get a Blu-ray UHD player and...
Oh, there's a lot going on in there in terms of what they did pack into it. You want to make an equivalent computer, you're at least 700, if not 8, 9, depending on how a game's optimized for the Silicon. There's all kinds of stuff going on with what does and doesn't work with it.
I remember I think you liked Madden 18. That was your favorite of the bunch.
I was stunned. Yeah, it's because you can't watch the NFL in 4K because nobody in the broadcast pipeline has figured out how to make Best Buy's sales pitch actually matter to football. You know, you go in, they're like, hey, it's going to be great for the big game. No, not at all. So you have to play the video game version to get 4K football. All the coaches still look like creepy zombie skeletons.
Well, that's the question is you're still stuck in Uncanny Valley with no way
out. A little
bit,
but it's getting better.
Yeah. Even Call of Duty had that problem too with the cut. Even the cutscenes was like, "There's something wrong with his teeth."
Well, I'm still pressing X to pay respects.
All right, we are gathered together to discuss the week's tech news. There is an unlimited supply, but let's start off with the breaking story, almost breaking, about Apple's iPhone and the mass killing in Texas. The Texas church shooting. Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General of the United States. I've got to get his quote because his quote, I think, is something we can kind of analyze here. So let me pull that up. The gunman's cell phone is locked, and here's the quote that Rosenstein gave the Washington Examiner. No reasonable person questions our right to access the phone. Should I stop there, or do you guys want to say anything about that?
Oh, man, here we go again.
But the company that built it, which we believe is as Apple, claims that it purposely designed the operating system so the company cannot open the phone, even with an order from a federal judge. Rosenstein said, lamenting only maybe eventually will federal investigators be able to access Kelly's phone. But this is the one that, of course, got all the headlines. In addition to costing a great deal of time and money, a delay surely costs lives. Apple is costing lives.
It's more of the same BS from law enforcement, right? It is, first off, he says supposedly or they claim that they can't access it, which is suggesting what? That there's actually a secret back door and they're just playing possum, which is ludicrous. Apple also pointed out that
that's a good point. We should underscore that word. The company claims it can't access it, like he doesn't believe it.
Yeah, it's super sketchy. And I think somebody pointed out, I think even Apple pointed out that they had that moment where they could have. So you've got the shooter, he's dead, and you've got the phone. If he had Touch ID on his phone, there's a 2-day timeout for Touch ID. So if they had contacted Apple, Apple could have done something like tell them to put his fingers on it and see if they could get it unlocked that way. But after that, then the passcode is in there and the encryption's locked in. And it sounds like they didn't ask Apple.
This is exactly what Apple said, though, in the San Bernardino case. They said, well, if you just asked us, we would have told you he could bring his phone home and it would back up to iCloud. We could give you that data because we do have access to the iCloud backups. Apple seems to be, this position seems to be, well, shucks, guys, you should call us sooner. Now this is going to precipitate, I would imagine, the same kind of back and forth that happened after the San Bernardino killing. And I guess there is a point to be made that there may be something on that phone that would help in the investigation. Perhaps, for instance, there were others involved in the shooting. And those people are unapprehended, but the phone might indicate that with text messages or phone calls. We do think that he called his father after he was shot in the chase that ensued after the shooting. I'm not going to say his name. You know what I'm talking about. We don't need to give any more publicity to that. But there's the larger question of why doesn't our Department of Justice understand that a backdoor to any phone or any encryption would be dangerous. it would solve this one problem, but it would open a Pandora's box of other problems.
Well, the other thing that's interesting to me, at least, is like, you know, first of all, this is one of those stories that makes me say, okay, what year is it again? We already did this. We already had this entire conversation. Granted, there are new phones out, and the Touch ID is part of this. But like, a lot of these examples that were these tragedies that we are experiencing still seem to be mostly, for lack of a better term, lone wolf situations, right? And I think that trying to make this argument that you're going to get information, clearly this information is important in the case, right? Or the information that law enforcement wants to get is important in the case. All information that they can get is important in a case like this. But at the same time, it just doesn't seem like any of these examples have shown that you're going to actually get that much more from unlocking a phone like this. And as the security community makes, I think, a valid argument, it's a really slippery slope. And as soon as you build the back door, as soon as you open this stuff up, it's just that much more vulnerable and more harm comes than good.
I really wish that politicians would step in and say, we should wait a little while before talking about security and unlocking. It's too soon. God, that'd be so nice if they used that tactic for this sort of thing. But, you know, like you were saying, Sarus over at Ars Technica, he quoted researcher Bruce Schneier, who was just saying the restaurant analogy. Yeah, poison all the food in a restaurant. You may get a terrorist, but you're going to make everybody else sick. And that's missing the point of the Constitution. Investigators don't like the Constitution because it gives us freedoms that sometimes makes their job a little difficult. So, sorry, we live in a free state and are afforded very important freedoms. And that includes, in my opinion, the ability to have high-level encryption in a telephone, and that, you know, evidence can be gathered in other ways. You know, innocent until proven guilty, prove guilty. I'm not saying that I am super stoked about really bad people being able to more cleverly hide information that could be used to prosecute them and render justice. But we're in America, and I think that is way more important than these one-off cases.
I mean, there's also, the argument to be made, well, what did law enforcement do before smartphones? I mean, this is brand new stuff. This contains more information than anything we've ever had before. Location, I mean, all sorts of information gathered.
One of the things they did before was search the house, right? We didn't have all of that personal information. It was just the stuff that was in your brain. But encryption makes this a little bit different, and I understand that. And in fact, this guy, in one of his more kind of deep interviews, did unfortunately what the Washington Post editorial board did not too long ago too, which is this weird wish casting where they say, surely there's a way that we can have people have privacy, but also have a way for law enforcement to get in. And the answer is no, that's not how cryptography works.
That's the biggest problem.
That's not how math works.
They have a fantasy that there is a way to do some sort of escrow or key escrow or something that would give law enforcement a backdoor. They still have that illusion, even after the NSA accidentally released all of its exploits to the wild, causing the massive Petya ransomware epidemic, that they somehow could do this magically. I don't know what we do. I hope we don't get a San Bernardino redux here. But it feels like we're headed that way.
Yeah, me too. I've already seen this movie. Yeah. I don't feel like we need to see it again. But
is he accurate when he says no reasonable person questions our right to access the phone?
He's not accurate.
Okay.
So many people question law enforcement's right to access the phone. In my opinion,
us are saying so. Yeah.
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 Well, and I don't know. If there were a perfect world where you could say, yeah, there's a way that they could get the phone without risking all of us, without poisoning all the diners in the restaurant. That's a great analogy. If there were a way to do that, I wouldn't be against them having access to that guy's phone. That's evidence, right?
Fair. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I really fear the day that, yeah, like you're saying, something leaks. And every BitTorrent site I can imagine just says, yeah, all these tools, that the government has gotten that all reasonable people believe they should have access to, well, now they're just available on any random Russian server, and boom, that's it.
There's also the larger issue of if the American government has the back door, every other government in the world is going to ask for a back door.
If
they don't have it already. But if Apple demonstrates there's a way to do this for law enforcement, then China's going to want it. Russia's going to want it. Everybody's going to want it. And it's going to be used in ways that, you know, here in the United States, we would consider reprehensible, to round up dissidents, to spy on the populace, things like that. You can't do this selective unlock, I guess. But why doesn't Rod Rosenstein, he's a smart man. Why doesn't he understand this? Why are we having this conversation?
Politics?
I think he understands it, but he's like trying to do the job that he's tasked with doing, and he's trying to move the goal lines or
but
the goal.
But he's going to whip up constantly. The problem is that there are, you know, of the vast majority of Americans don't hear this conversation, don't understand. If you don't understand why it's bad to have a back door, and most people don't, then it doesn't make sense that Apple says no. You don't understand. Why would Apple not want to help the FBI? What's wrong with them? But if you understand this backdoor issue, this math issue, but I don't think most people do, right? So we need to spread the word. Tell everybody you know. There's no such thing as a secure backdoor. A backdoor is a backdoor. I love the restaurant analogy. I get it, Bruce Schneier touring America, telling everybody about it. Let's see. All right. Well, we'll move on. But I thought that was probably the big story of the week. That or sending your nudes to Facebook. I can't decide.
Oh, man.
Do you need help? Like, I've got a really nice little green screen thing I can help you with.
What is wrong with Facebook? By the way, I have to say, so Facebook's proposal is that if you are worried about revenge porn, where you have a bad breakup, boyfriend has nude pictures of you, he gets his revenge by posting them on Facebook. If you're worried about that, Facebook's solution is, well, send us the nude pictures you're worried about.
Why are you struggling to say that without laughing?
You do it in Messenger, you flag the picture, and then
you have to do it in Messenger?
Yeah,
jeez.
That's secure. And then a human at Facebook will review it to make sure that it's not just a picture of Hillary Clinton or something. And then they'll hash it. We'll delete it, we promise. And we'll keep the hash and we'll just monitor all future uploads. Now, immediately, by the way, as soon as I read this story, Jeff Jarvis, a very smart man, probably, you know, there are just engineers at Facebook who are at least as smart. He said, well, that's backwards. What you should do that doesn't even make any sense. If you see revenge porn, then you should upload it and they should get the hash and they can compare the hash. They should never, you don't need to send them the nude pictures for this to work. Duh.
Well, the problem ends up being that most of these, Twitter and Facebook largely are letting the robots do the work. So if you're sending legitimate issues to either of these companies, they get lost in the sea of things unless you're a verified account or some other thing brings your request to the top. Whereas they're listening to when there's a wave of complaints, those end up getting pushed up to the top. So this sort of system where they say, give us this data to put in our robot database, that lets them skip out on hiring the number of people necessary.
But there's a way to do this. So Jeff said, here's what you do. You distribute a program to everybody that's the hashing program. And you say, well, you do the hash and send it to us so that we have the hash. If we get a match, then a human can look at it and say, no, that's Hillary Clinton or that's revenge porn and yank it. But you don't have to send them the pictures. Just send them the hash. Run the hash locally. How hard is that to do, Facebook?
I would also maybe say, you know, get the Animoji in there. Get your iPhone 10 down. It can do all of the volumetric mapping. You can attach like maybe the monkey or hippo face to it. And then, you know, Facebook can just use that.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah. Why don't use Face ID to map our bodies and send the hash to Facebook? If you see my body, has anybody seen this? Never mind.
I do feel like this is an example of something where, and we talked about this around the celebrity iCloud account hacks. At the end of the day, I do still think it's true that the best possible solution is, like, don't put things on your phone that you wouldn't want people to see, like nude pictures and nude video. And now I know there's
that's
like some debate
the revenge
about whether
porn
that's
issue. I mean that
right, right. And
helps
so
Polaroid.
But I think right helps Polaroid. But I do think like that this is another example of like when a tech company thinks that there is a technological solution here, and maybe there is with like actually allowing the user to hash this stuff. But I just feel like at the end of the day, again, there's a human solution both on the Facebook side, which is actually hiring people to work harder to keep this stuff off of Facebook. And then there's a human solution on the user side, which is do not put stuff on your phone that you don't want people to see
and
at the end of the day.
And don't let your boyfriend take naked pictures of you.
Yeah, or your girlfriend, for that matter.
I think most revenge porn comes from men. That
also, the machine learning thing, like nude pictures are probably not really part of the terms of service anyway. So should they not also be just improving their machine learning to blot out any photos of this kind of content so that they all get just kind of knocked out in advance?
It was a while back that there had been disputes and complaints about that because they were nude images that were deemed culturally relevant that were automatically taken down because the robots
feeding,
said,
or
breastfeeding,
yeah,
that's right.
Pictures of the Madonna and child. Yeah, I mean, this is a
so
this
then
is
you
a
end up with that,
do. And it's a hard thing to do at scale with 2 billion users. Facebook's anti-revenge porn system. Here's the poll on the Register. As it stands, you think the Facebook system is a good idea or bad idea? Overwhelmingly,
wait, what did you vote in order because you had to vote to get that one.
Well, I think it's a bad idea. I'm not sending Facebook my nude pictures for some human to review. Who, by the way, who gets that job?
Oh, that's a whole nother article. I can't remember who's done features on that, but just the amount of PTSD.
The worst job ever, right?
Oh. Well, they're outsourced to pennies on the dollar countries where you just they log into the cloud and go, well,
image,
look at everything
image,
terrible.
Image.
And then, yeah. Don't look that stuff up if you want to feel good about anything ever again. But it's very fascinating coverage out there. I'm sorry that I don't know the name of outlets off the top of my head.
I remember that. No, I remember that reading that story. It was terrible. Horrible job.
We interviewed a guy on Codebreaker who had done this for I think it was Wicker, and you know he had a team. I forget the name. I forget what they called it, it was like safety
Wicker?
And compliance.
Is that the app for porch furniture? What is Wicker? What is Wicker?
I think it was Wicker, right? This app that existed very briefly people were sharing children porn or child porn, things like that. And you know it didn't. I don't know where it went, but the team that was you know, built around protecting the platform from this stuff and wiping it.
Yeah.
It's a really tough job. And these people, you know, these teams, it's a horrible job. It's also a really important job. But it's, man, you have to feel for those folks.
And that's a result of these companies, you know, going public and wanting to scale. You want more users. You want more user-generated content. You want more things that people create to make the platform valuable that save you as a company money. And then real life shows up and says, by the way, it's going to be terrible, your plan. So, you know, go ahead and keep up and try to save all the money and have a safe experience and so on. And I feel like we've got other stories in the mix that touch on some of the robot craziness that results. It's just insane.
The fact that Facebook would propose this and not think the response would be is kind of interesting, too. You feel like maybe some of these people at Facebook aren't really connected with the real world. They upload your nude pictures to us so we can protect you.
They're probably not even talking to women because I imagine the average white male San Francisco Bay Area tech guy is going to be like, what's wrong with uploading a picture of my penis to the internet? I've already done that via Tinder dating.
Seems like a good idea. I don't know what the problem would be. I mean, besides, it's going to be fun.
Like, what the hell? We'll talk about Facebook. Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, has unloaded on Facebook for exploiting humans. Think about the children, he said. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. I think there's an opportunity for an entrepreneur to create the new Wicker social network for lawn or porch furniture.
Porch furniture.
I'm excited about that. I might.
You think guys, that if it was actually wicker, like a chair service, they would have a filter that says chair, not chair.
Chair, not but, chair. Hot dog, not hot dog.
Hot dog, not hot dog. That's right.
It's great to have you. We've got a great team. Ben Johnson's here from Codebreaker. You're doing that full time now. Is that right?
Well, we haven't made a third season yet. That was actually my side hustle. And now I work for WBUR in Boston. So I'm still doing the NPR thing. But yeah, Codebreaker still up there.
Because the last time I talked to you, you said, I can't tell you what I'm up to. But
yes.
BUR is a great station. I love BUR.
Yeah. It's a good place to be. Boston is a great town. You know, it's... I used to hate Boston as a New Yorker, but now that I'm here, you know, I got to switch sides. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. You're not becoming a Red Sox fan or anything like that, anything weird like that.
I would never do that.
A Patriots fan. I hope not. I hope not. Jason Snell's also here. Six Colors, the great site he does with Dan Morin. And by the way, again, with the great graphs, we'll talk a little bit about Apple's amazing quarter, and you've made all the graphs using all six colors.
Although you noticed that, yeah, I've got a color palette. It's only six, though. Then I run out after that.
And have you done any Animoji karaokes, or are you abstaining?
I did. I did one where I reenact the scene between Khan and Captain Kirk in Star Trek II, which ends with him saying, Khan! And Khan, Kirk is a fox, and Khan is a... Oh, I'll send you a link. And I did a little bit of Daft Punk as the robot, because how could you not?
But I have to say, I think we survived the week and it's over now, right? I mean, I think that I noticed there's
it's got to be dying down, or it's going to go to another level. I think reenacting famous movie scenes as an emoji might be the next step, but we'll see.
Actually, I want to talk about the Clips app, because Apple has released an update to its app that is designed to use the Face ID on the iPhone 10, and actually is the most, to me so far, the most interesting use of that Face ID. I really like that. Very interesting. Also with us, and it's always great to have him. I don't think have you ever done, now Sam, you've been on TNT and TNW many times. Have you ever been on the big show?
I was on this show once, and I think the camera performance was so bad that you told a producer to just never call me again.
Never call. So.
I
quintupled
my internet. I'm now up to about 150 baud upload, so I think I can finally keep up.
No, you look great. And you got a bunch of games behind you that look fun.
Oh, yeah. The party's over here afterwards, everybody. Come on over.
Are you one of those tabletop gaming types that you have, like, actual people in your house?
I don't know how to answer that without stealing the entire rest of the show, Leo.
I see Catan behind you.
Oh, that's lightweight. That's just to sneak people in before I hit him with Blood Rage.
Oh, God.
Which is not, that's not like a euphemism. That's the name of a game. Sorry.
So how many nights a week are you tabletop gaming?
It depends on when my friends are able to get away from their families. You know, I can't play these by myself, and all my best players are dads and moms. And so it's sort of like once the kids are passed out and it's all good, then we can go to one person's house where there's a kid and have a monitor, and then every once in a while the dice rolling will be interrupted by I have to take care of another living, breathing person. Terrible for game flow, I will say, but it works.
Come
out.
Come on, I want to be a Viking clans pillage and battle in a quest for glory at the end of the world. Wow.
Yeah, that one is a fine game. I actually tried that out for free at one of the PAX expos here in Seattle, and immediately went out and bought it. And the guy put that up on Kickstarter back when everyone was doing way too many Kickstarters, and it was just, oh, look at all these pretty minis, all these little figurines, but turned out to actually have a decent game, and he's gone on to be way too overrated, but also quite darn good at making a fun board game where you're managing bloody Viking things.
I think any game where you have 46 highly detailed miniatures, that's for me. Good Lord.
get that Christmas list going.
If you lose one of the pieces, can you not play the game? It's like your shot. You got 45.
You just have to wait until you poop it out.
Oh, okay. That's a fun prospect. It's good to have you here. Mashkovich. Milady Mashkovich. That's how he told. I don't know why you told me that. Now I'm going to call you Milady from now on.
You know, maybe I'm just looking for something a little more genteel in my life during these dark times.
Our show today brought to you by The Ring. they call it the Ring Video Doorbell. It's really more than that now. Ring is an amazing company with the doorbell, which I've had for a couple of years that I have right in my front door. I replaced my old ding-donger with that. It was easy to do, and I'm no handyman. It took me about an hour. They say you could do it in half an hour, but I work slow. And then all of a sudden, I've got not just a doorbell, which still rings, you know, the chimes in my house, but attached to it is a camera, high-def video camera, a microphone, a speaker, and motion sensors. Now, anybody comes up my front to my porch, I see them. I can talk to them. If they ring the doorbell, I can pretend I'm in the house. I'm in the bathtub. Leave the package. If they leave the package, I could keep an eye on it. I love this. Ring has created a new neighborhoods program where other people, with your permission and theirs, in your neighborhood who have Ring doorbells, you can have a kind of a neighborhood watch. It's brilliant. This is so great. And now they've expanded. They're getting bigger all the time. They've taken the Ring doorbell and they've created the Ring floodlight cam. It's basically, you know, one of those floodlights that you have on the, you've always had on the side of your house. It's motion activated. The light comes on. You've seen those before. Well, first of all, these are LED lamps, so they last a really long time. They're beautiful. They're very bright. And they got the camera, the speaker, the microphone on it. So somebody comes down around your house, the lights come on, you can see them, you get a notification wherever you are in the world, because it's all on the internet, you get pinged, you can see them, you can speak to them, and if they don't get out of there, you could sound a 110 decibel alarm all from your phone, no matter where you are. When things go bump in the night, you don't have to get up and go check, you just take your phone out and say, well, who's out there? Hello! Raccoons, get away! The Ring floodlight cam was named Wall Street Journal's Best of CES 2017. And now we've got a deal, the Ring of Security Kit, that'll include a Ring video doorbell, either the original, which is what I have, or the new Pro. Your choice of either one, two, or three floodlight cams. Surround your home with security. The doorbell works with your favorite smart locks and hubs. It works with Amazon's Echo, too. So I actually have the Echo show with the screen, and I can say, show my front door or show my backyard. I name the it's fantastic. With Ring, you're always home no matter where you are anywhere in the world. Save up to $150 off a Ring of Security Kit, but you got to go to ring.com/twit for that deal. ring.com/twit. Everybody ought to have one. And you know, as we get closer to the holidays, this is a very nice gift to give your parents, your family. ring.com/twit. We're talking the week's tech news. Apple had an amazing quarter. The numbers are in. Is it their, not only is it one of their best quarters ever, I think it was a record, but they say, get ready because next quarter's going to be even bigger.
Yeah, that's the big thing, right? Like Wall Street is not interested in what's happening now. They want to know what's happening in the future. And so, yeah, it was their biggest fiscal fourth quarter ever, which is like that's their sleepiest quarter ever too, every year, but it was the biggest one of those. But the holiday quarter is always the biggest one. That's the first quarter of their next fiscal year. And the guidance they gave to Wall Street when they made their announcement about this quarter was that will be the biggest Apple quarter of any kind ever, which means that you can do the math about iPhone sales. It's probably like, I don't know, 85 million iPhones. So anybody who's writing that narrative of like, oh, well, Apple has peaked and they're headed back down, it looks like that's not true. They're continuing to grow. They had that one aberrant year where they were way up, but the growth is back in action, and they're gonna sell a lot of iPhones. They're going to break 80 million, I think, for the first time, and it'll probably be by a lot.
46 million with the iPhone 8 and whatever other models were sold, but I would say probably mostly iPhone 8.
And
now the next quarter they got the iPhone 10. So
the average selling price is going to go way up, which means the revenue is going to go way up because they're going to have more iPhone 8 and 8 Plus sales, and they're going to have iPhone 10 sales, and so the money is going to keep going up. The iPad has had two good quarters in a row.
That's kind of surprising. It had been, as you could
super
see,
surprising.
It had been shrinking.
It was a bad few years, but they've had two consecutive quarters of growth. Last quarter was big, but the average selling price was down. It was big in units, which meant they sold a lot of the cheap iPads. But this last 3 months, the average selling price went way up, which means that the iPad Pro was starting to kind of kick it into gear. It'll be interesting to see if they can keep that momentum for the holidays, which traditionally is the best-selling iPad quarter. So they really, you know, have a chance between the low-cost iPad and the two iPad Pro models to kind of keep the momentum momentum going on the iPad. And another thing that happened is that Apple pointed out that this is the best financial year of Mac revenue ever, not quite on units, but on Mac revenue. And so the Mac businesses, even though we just kind of ignore it because it's such a small part of Apple's business, is also back in growth and doing well. And I think they said they sold a record number of Macs in China last quarter. So they're doing really well kind of across the board after a year. There was a year where they were down year over year every single quarter. And then for the last couple of years, there's been a question about the Mac and the iPad and whether they're kind of shaky. But right now, they're firing on all cylinders.
I was curious if anybody has noticed anecdotally iPad Pro use going up just among people you might not expect to grab iPads, because that's what I've noticed in the past couple of weeks. Just hearing friends mention casually about people, younger friends of mine having to train older folks about in their workplaces or families about how to use the iPad Pro, that people seem to be really interested in laptop level size and functionality and speed, but you know, don't need the keyboard, just want to have this big thing that can kind of do a lot. So I don't know if anyone else has noticed that or if that's just my small sphere of the world, but that does seem to be happening. And that's really good news for an iPad that, as we've all kind of noticed for years, has just been slumping.
I've noticed that for sure. And what's interesting to me, not only the kind of narrative change just like in the past few quarters, but also there were folks for a long time, you know, be first or be best, right? And there were folks for a long time that were really like gravitating towards the Surface and the Surface Pro sort of line of stuff. I had a lot of friends who were Apple users for a long time, but the Surface was just more useful for them in terms of what they were doing. And then more recently, I've heard a lot of people who have kind of finally gotten into the iPad Pro. So I think I definitely think, at least anecdotally, that seems to be happening. Microsoft was in some ways, I think, first in terms of this actual tablet that was useful for business in a way, but Apple seems to be gaining on them, and maybe that's because in some ways the iPad is better for folks.
Yeah, Surface revenues, the Microsoft quarter, Surface revenues, I think, fell. I'm using a Surface Studio right now, but I don't think this is the Surface you're talking about. This is their all-in-one. You're talking about the Surface Notepad.
Yeah, the Surface 4 Pro, I mean, that's like the last major one, really. We've, you know, Peter Bright over at ours has just been like, when are they going to do something that excites that sector? Because it's been a good product and an overpriced product for a while. So, it's, you know, Apple's showing up and saying, hey, every time it's getting a little better and we're going to include more people in that promise of a business useful lap tab, whatever you want to call it.
Conventional wisdom was that the iPad Pro sales are slowing, not because people don't like it, but because they've saturated the market and you don't need to get a new iPad particularly.
I think that it's been down so long that maybe we've reached the point where now it's sort of back into a normal kind of replenishment. And also, let's not forget, Apple this year did some differentiation of the iPad for the very first time. It was always like, well, it's the iPad and there's an old model and there's the mini. And this year it's like, no, we have the iPad Pro and they're going to be more expensive, but they're going to have you can add a keyboard and they've got the Pencil and all of that. And then we've got the iPad, which is going to be a lot cheaper than the iPad's ever been before. And if that's all you want, you can get that. And I think that clarity has really served them well, that you can get the cheap iPad or you can go up to the iPad Pro and get that keyboard. The existence of that, you can always use a keyboard with an iPad, but the existence of the Apple smart keyboard, I think triggers a lot of people into buying, being like, oh yeah, that's good. It can be a real computer if I want it to be, even if they don't ever use the keyboard.
Well, it would require, and a couple of things happened. iOS 11, which gave it more desktop style features,
totally,
like a dock and multitasking and so forth. But also, I think eventually you would expect app developers would start to accommodate the new form factor and provide more productivity stuff. There's Affinity Pro, which is pretty close to Lightroom. There's good video. There's a plethora of good video editors. You can do more and more, I guess, is what I'm saying, with an iPad, and so it can be used more and more as your main computer.
Yeah, it's matured as a device for sure. I edit a lot of podcasts on the iPad Pro now too. It can handle uncompressed audio. The adding a keyboard is easy, and there are a lot of keyboard accessories too. There's a lot to be said for it, kind of evolving as a platform and not being afraid of saying, yeah, Pro's in the name. You can actually do work on this, so people don't shy away from it.
So,
well, and Apple's also figuring out the market too, right? It's figuring out where it can sell this, some of this stuff who it can sell, you know, to. And I think that that is another part of this, that over time, you know, Apple has kind of started to figure that out when it comes to the iPad suite of products.
Well, if you're going to be bullish on Apple, obviously next quarter, because that'll be the first quarter with the iPhone 10 sales, which seem to be very strong just by how hard it is to get and the number of people raving about it. And all the reviews have been very positive. So that's going to be a big growth quarter. And I would imagine, well, you talk a little bit about it, Jason, in the most recent post on Six Colors, that at some point, first of all iPhones are going to look like the 10.
Yeah, it's it'll take a while, but the home button, I think all iOS devices are going to get rid of the home button
eventually.
Once
you use a 10,
Face ID.
Once you use this new user interface, you don't want to go back. It feels old fashioned to use even an iPhone 8. My 2 month old iPhone 8 feels old, and the iPad needs to be updated. You imagine a bezel-less, touch ID-less iPad in this year?
Yeah, there was somebody who did some mock-ups on Twitter that
Benjamin
I linked to.
Benjamin Geskin.
Yeah, they're very nice. The idea that you can make the bezels a little bit narrower. It's not going to be an OLED screen or something. And Mark Herman did a report this week, because they're really expensive and hard to get in quantity at quality in the size of an iPad screen.
I have an OLED 13-inch laptop, the Lenovo X1 Yoga, and I
think we've seen that Apple's really conservative about rolling OLED into other products, and and the Gurman report says it's so expensive that they're like just not going to do it.
It would double
and
the price or something.
Yeah, exactly right. But they are going to do Face ID in next year's iPad, according to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, and so that's really interesting. There are some issues with the smaller bezel that they've already had to deal with a little bit the last time they redesigned the iPad, where they need to do some kind of hand rejection stuff, so that if you're gripping the side of it, it knows that's not actually an interface touch, and you should ignore that. I mean, let's not leave out the iMac and the laptops too. Face ID, I feel like more than Touch ID, Face ID is going to be the thing that comes to the Mac. And like with Windows Hello, this idea that you can kind of like just smile at your computer and it'll unlock. And I think Apple's going to go down that route with the iMac and the MacBooks too.
It's a little bit of a pain. This uses Windows Hello in the camera, but I have to kind of tilt it to get it at the right angle. It's not. I mean, Apple will do a better job. Because
that's
of
the challenge
the sensors,
with the iPad, right? You got to get it like portrait and landscape, and the angles are a little different. And you got to make sure that that infrared sensor can see you, or the jig is up. So they got to do it right if they're going to do it.
Do you guys all use Face ID and Touch ID and these kinds of things? Because I always avoid it.
What do you enter a passcode, Ben?
Yeah, I'm a passcode guy.
Jeez,
because
Louise.
I think actually the last time we talked, Leah, we talked about this idea that actually Cyrus has at ours has done, Cyrus Farivar has done some reporting on this idea of like, you know, what you are versus what you know.
Yeah, but are you afraid the feds are going to demand?
Well, you know, it's like one of those things. It's again, it's like
I'm not worried about the feds. I'm not worried about the feds. I'm not.
If you think about it, it's a like a shortcut, though. I mean, Apple is pretty diligent about this. Anybody who's used biometrics on an Apple device knows that every so often it asks you for your passcode. And one of the nice things about having the biometric on there is that you can make it more than a 4 or 6 digit password.
I have an alphanumeric
passcode on my iPhone.
Yeah.
And it asks, so you know, there is a limit to it. It's not going to unlock all my secrets forever for a limited time for convenience sake. But I would be much more hesitant about it if I knew that my thumbprint would always unlock everything no matter what. But that's not, as we mentioned about the shooter in that earlier case, after a time period, his thumb, even if you've got his dead body, won't unlock the phone because there's a knowledge element, which is his password, that's involved. So I'm not as worried about it. But the nice thing is it is a convenience feature and you can turn it off. But I'm loving Face ID because it just kind of drops that layer of inconvenience in repeatedly putting in a passcode.
I look forward
to
the viral
video.
Don't
you get scared? Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, don't you get scared of giving your like, I don't want to give Apple or Google or anybody my fingerprints and I guess facial recognition, that ship has sailed.
I trust. Well, yeah, you walk down the street, you're giving them your face ID. But I trust that Apple, when they say that we don't store these on our servers, we make a hash. And the hash is, you know, the actual fingerprints.
It's stored on device, yeah.
It's device only in the secure enclave. I think that's fine.
They're not even storing your face print or your fingerprint on the device. They're doing a mathematical construct that's removed from it. It's basically like making a cryptographic key. And then that gets stored in the secure enclave and never gets synced to the cloud.
Except if I then use Snapchat And it's using, and I don't think Snapchat is yet using the Face ID.
Well, that's the thing, is that Snapchat and third-party apps don't get access to the Face ID system. They get access to a lower resolution infrared-based depth system. So they're not actually handing over the keys to the whole store.
So they get a little bit. There's an API, I presume, that because the Apple Clips app, for instance, uses the front-facing Face ID camera to do some really spectacular kind of
presumably that's like their a private API. But
you don't think they'll offer
apps,
that to Face to Snapchat? Because boy, I bet Snapchat would love this.
I'm sure they would, but right now Snapchat's using ARKit, so they're using this, like, it's not all of the crown jewels. It's like a limited version, and they have to go through Apple's system to do it. So that's why I do trust I believe what they say, which is that they put a lot of security emphasis on keeping the stuff on device and not giving it to people who can't be trusted. And so, you know, that reassures me that my thumbprint isn't just like floating around the internet right now.
Look, me and my microphone are in Brooklyn. I don't know. You can't really see that very well. But this is the Clips app. This is in real time. Partly, this is the A11. The fact that it can rotoscope in real time is mind-boggling. But then it's using Face ID to put me in Brooklyn. And that's kind of,
I was wondering why the rents are going up over there.
There's a giant rotoscoped Leo looming over. This does 8-bit. It puts me in you can be in the Millennium Falcon. And actually, I discovered this great effect, because if you cover the Face ID, you disappear. So you can appear into the Millennium Falcon if you want. This is obviously a technology demo, although it has some value. And it's also pretty impressive that they can even do this.
I just worry about the Philip K. Dick sort of moment when it's going to be a viral video of somebody being apprehended and an officer just grabbing the phone and holding it up to a perp and the guy just like closing his eyes and dodging just so it doesn't unlock. It's going to happen within the next 2 years, sure. I swear.
Well, it did happen. Somebody, remember the story where the guy, they got his phone unlocked and they jumped him? They waited till he unlocked his phone and they jumped him and they took it?
Oh, geez.
I think it's already happened.
I just mean the viral video aspect. But
oh,
yes.
Yeah. Seeing that on a viral video. I have to say, I even turned off, you know, there is the feature that you have to look at it with your eyes open. I turned that off. I want it to work all the time. I'm not worried. I'm not really worried about somebody sneaking up to me in my sleep.
You're going to sleepwalk with that thing.
No,
you're going
what?
To buy so much weird stuff.
All right. I keep waiting for Apple to run out of momentum, run out of steam, and there's no evidence at all. I frankly was not thrilled with the new MacBook Pros. They're selling like crazy. I have to say, yeah. The iPhone X is remarkable. Is in fact a great improvement, and that means they're going to have another incredible quarter. And if they put some of these features, if not all of them, on an iPad Pro, suddenly the iPad's going to take off in big ways.
It's going to take another category, right? It's going to need to take a category that is not the PC and not the smartphone. Maybe it's AR.
The rumors that said Apple by 2020 will have, there you go, AR, this is Mark Gurman again, who's very reliable, will have basically spectacles that look like your regular prescription glasses, but have augmented reality built in, a computer, a battery, sufficient battery to run it, a heads-up
display.
Here's
my question about that story. What does succeed the iPhone mean? What do they actually mean by that?
I don't think Apple's saying that. Maybe Mark's saying that.
Right. That's like a headline writer.
Yeah.
Nothing's replacing the smartphone for a very long time because smartphone is so that's going to be a while. That's like everybody saying, what's the next iPhone? What's the next smartphone? It's like that may be a generational kind of product.
It's not a huge
AR or VR. Maybe
it's not a huge leap to think, though, that if you could make spectacles much like your standard prescription glasses that had AR, that had HoloLens or something like it built in, that would be a new category that would be a market killer, right? That would be amazing.
Yeah. Game changer.
Game changer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, Apple's not the only one. Clearly, Microsoft's working on it. Google's working on it.
Yeah.
But that's why it's going to be a while.
Yeah.
The first company that makes it quote unquote magical, that makes it not look obnoxious, that makes it superior to, let's be clear, this experience of where you just stare at the screen and you're, whenever I go to a cafe,
you
I see people
doing
that.
You do that when you stare at your screen? That's the face you make? That's
that
weird.
Is the face I see a lot of people make.
Well, they're
that's
doing Snapchat.
I'm hateful.
Yeah,
but
no,
my
that's
point
Snapchat.
Is, there's, I think there is absolutely room in the crazy tech dreamer world of making something that is on your person at all the time, connects you to your work and your social life digitally, that could be transformative. I say this as someone who has really fallen for cool things in VR and then tripped over cables and bulk and all this other stuff. I just see that. I'm not saying that's going to happen in 2 years, but I do think that is the race right now, whether that's really possible in terms of size, price, heat. Like, there's all kinds of factors, but it doesn't shock me that Apple would say, yeah, we can go quote-unquote magical because we've essentially been making the same sort of slab device with a phone for a while. But that doesn't mean they're going to pull it off.
I think you can assume it's going to happen. Of course, you can't predict the time frame exactly. But there's nothing required to make that happen that doesn't kind of isn't on the timeline. There's no massive paradigm shift that's required, no massive invention that's required to make that happen. Just the standard improvement of battery life, miniaturization, all of those things are doable.
Think is going to help with
5G,
this, right?
You're going to have massive bandwidths.
Absolutely.
It also just has to not look stupid. That is probably the above every other technological innovation.
Do you think
innovation.
The AirPods look stupid,
if Google
Sam?
Google Glass taught us anything.
Yeah, no, I know Google Glass is dopey, but do you think AirPods look... We thought AirPods looked dopey, but you see them everywhere now.
I think they're okay. I don't think they look dopey. I don't think they're like, oh my God, they're making me look cooler. They're acceptable, but I'm don't ask
yeah,
me.
Yeah, it can't be a Geordie style visor. Or, well, actually, that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, hold the phone. Come on.
Come on.
Could it look like Snapchat spectacles? Those are kind of...
No.
All right. Let's take a break. I want to talk about this Sean Parker and really the larger issue, which you've been spending a lot of time on lately. About, you mentioned it, Sam, you know, people living on their screen and not living in their life, and the larger issue of kind of the massive addictiveness of modern technologies, particularly smartphones and social media. When we come back, Milady Sam Moscovich is here from Ars. You're going to be called that from now on. Tech culture editor at Ars Technica, Sam Red. I like that on the Twitter. Jason Snell from SixColors.com and the incomparable... He is a professional podcaster witness. The high-end Shure microphone that he is using today.
You got to have a microphone.
That's a good mic. But that's like professional grade. That's a good microphone. That's not one of these Heil PR40 amateurish podcaster microphones. That's a real Mikey.
They're comparable. They're not incomparable. They're incomparable.
They're incomparable. What is that behind you? It looks like an Emmy Award. What is that? An Oscar? You got an Oscar?
It's a Mac. I got the Macworld Eddie Award because I ran the Eddie Awards for so long that when I left, I took one.
There was one left in the closet.
Going out the door.
It was literally. Yeah. It was an extra.
Yeah. Ben Johnson's also here from Codebreaker and WBUR NPR Radio for Boston, NPR News for Boston. Are you their tech reporter, Ben, or are you general assignment? What are you doing at BUR?
Oh man, I'm doing lots of secret things. But the thing that I'm doing that's not secret is that I'm reporting for Here and Now, which is the sort of third most listened to NPR show behind All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And so I'm doing some tech reporting for them, and also making a podcast about a website that you've probably heard of, but I won't say any more just yet.
What the hell?
What does it rhyme with?
Schmace-cluck?
Schmace Cluck.
I don't know.
You know, it's
Spitter?
The front page of the internet. Front page of the internet. That's all I'll say.
Smoogle? Oh, my Yahoo. Okay. That was my front page. Here and Now is a great show. That is a great assignment. Fun. And this new podcast is coming soon to a...
It'll be announced in December. First week of December.
Nice.
It'll be coming soon. And hopefully more Codebreaker.
It's Schmedit. You're doing the Schmedit.
The Schmedit podcast. That's right.
Are you just going to take Eddie's name and just add Schma to the beginning? I really like this. I want Schmeiss to come back myself.
Lisa Schmeiser will be here next week. She'll help me. You know, we tried to do a podcast on Reddit. I thought it was a great idea, but we just couldn't make it work. And then Reddit
didn't get enough upvotes.
You didn't get enough upvotes. Reddit did one that didn't get enough upvotes either. So I hope you do a good job with that. I think I look forward to the Schmedit show.
The Schmedit show.
Yeah, that's right. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. If you want to, if you're a business and you don't have a website, shame on you. How are your customers going to find you? Oh, I have a Facebook page. I have a Twitter account. That's not how you do it. First of all, they own your page, not you. You need to have a place on the... Sure, you should have a Facebook page. You should have a Twitter account, but they should all point back to your website. That's your presence on the net. That's where customers find out what you do, how to get a hold of you, who you are. They get to build a bond with you that really makes a difference. And when you do it on WordPress.com, you don't have to spend any energy learning, you know, web technologies and SEO. They do it all for you. They make it really easy. You could focus on your content, focus on building your business. The other reason I use WordPress.com, the other reason is because that's a community. It is. There are lots of people on WordPress.com. And the WordPress follow button means you're going to get more people. They make it easy for your users, your customers, your fans to share your content on their social networks. They've got great plugins, built-in search engine optimization. They do all the technical stuff. In fact, they have a great help team if you need them. You probably won't. 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and weekends too. I used them. I just wanted to try them out, and I got some great stuff. I said, here's what I want to do. What template should I use? They had a recommendation. Hundreds of beautiful templates to choose from. Prices, very affordable. In fact, I used to run my own hosted WordPress site. I had my own server and all that, and I was spending more for that than I spend right now for my WordPress site. They do the hosting, and then they do something that I got tired of doing, which is keeping it up to date, making sure everything's working and flowing, and they support me, which is fantastic. You know, 28% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. Maybe your business should consider it. WordPress.com/twit. If you go there right now, you get 15%. Wait a minute. Is it now 29%? It's up. You know, I want to take credit because when we started doing these ads, it was 27%. And then it went to 28%, and now it is 29%. I think that extra 2% is Twit right there. WordPress.com/Twit. We're going to get you 15% off any new plan purchase. WordPress.com/Twit. We thank him so much for making LeoLaporte.com possible and for doing a great job making the web, 29% of the web possible. That's kind of mind-boggling.
Wow.
Yeah, that number keeps going up. So Sean Parker, he is the first president. He's the guy in the movie, I don't think he did this in real life, who said, you know what's better than $1 million? $1 billion. He's the guy in the movie who kind of took Mark Zuckerberg under his wing, and I think somewhat did. He had been at Napster, had startup experience, and kind of brought some adult supervision to Facebook, was its first president. Now he seems like he's having some regrets. He spoke at an Axios event in Philadelphia. He's doing kind of philanthropy. He is the chair of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. But he said, after he left the stage, he said, Mark Zuckerberg will probably block my Facebook account after hearing about this. Here's the quotes. And I thought these were really interesting. When Facebook was getting going, I had these people who would come up to me and say, oh, I'm not on social media. And I would say, Sean Parker would say, oh, you know, you will be. And then they would say, no, I value my real life interactions. I value the moment. I value presence. I value intimacy. And I would say, we will get you eventually. I don't know if I really understood the consequences of what I was saying. Because when a network grows to 1 or 2 billion people, it literally changes your relationship with society, with each other. It probably interferes with productivity in weird ways, yes. God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. The thought process that went into building those applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? That's the metric, right? It still is for Facebook. Engagement. How do we engage you? How do we keep you on the news feed? And of course, thanks to big data, thanks to algorithms, they automatically get better and better and better. He says it means we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented a photo or a post or whatever, and that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you more likes and contents. It's a social validation feedback loop, exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like me would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. The inventors, creators, it's me, it's Mark, it's Kevin Systrom on Instagram, it's all of these people, understood this consciously, and we did it anyway. Kind of a mea culpa.
Yeah, just on time. There's no way he could have thought of any of this any sooner. I gotta say.
Well, he admits we were thinking this. We did this on purpose.
Well, yeah, he's finally sounding the alarm. Good job. Way to get there. But I gotta say, him talking about being a hacker that way makes me mad. Because, yes, there's something to be said about exploiting systems, but hackers aren't about destroying people for their own gain. They're about understanding systems to make the world better or more interesting. And that's not what he's alleging here. So there's a single finger I have in mind for a comment like that. Decrying hacker nature. Additionally, you know, we all know this about the dopamine hits sort of stuff. I will say Facebook seems to be ramping it up, trying to find ways to make you feel liked or interacted with your community, even when they're not there. I'll say anecdotally in my experience, it's been a lot of there's an event happening near you or friends are interested in an event happening near you. They're not. They did not hit like or I'm attending or I'm interested. It's just this sort of way of saying there's events and you've shown interest in other stuff before. Ergo, we're going to connect the dots so you get a notification when you're actually kind of a lonely loser who doesn't have people directly like you. You know, they're not stopping in terms of that attempt to take all of the information they have and make you feel like you are directly being interacted with and valued as a result. You've already fallen for the like button and the sad button and the lol button, and we need to make sure there's just more buttons in your life. So, you know, he's not declaring anything new there, but Facebook is absolutely ramping that up in real time.
Well, it's interesting too. There's actually a name for this, what he's talking about. And it's randomly reinforced behavior. This is what, you know, we talked to somebody on Codebreaker, an informatics professor about this, and email does this as well. This way of kind of like getting you to randomly check to see if anyone has checked in with you, for instance. And Facebook, you know, email from email to Facebook to Snapchat, et cetera, these are all programs that are really getting us as humans to increase our randomly reinforced behavior. And it's really hard to detrain yourself or like untrain yourself from doing that. And I think, you know, I'll also say, like, I think that this is a really fashionable time to be talking about this kind of thing.
Because of the election, you know, and fake news, I think that's what
exactly
really precipitated it.
Yeah. And it just feels like he's, you know, I don't know
he's
how much kudos
on.
He deserves. He necessarily. Yeah. But I I'll also say, like, you know, a statement like God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. Now, on the other side of this, I just think that that's like one of those like randomly, I don't that's not a really helpful statement, right? It's like, it's increasing the kind of irrational fears that people do have about technology. And I think those, you know, that's true too, right? You have all these parents kind of feeling like, oh my God, like what do I do? And, you know, I was raised by parents who were really scared about like what TV was going to be doing to my brain when I was growing up.
Right.
And they prevented me from watching television all the time.
An hour a night. Come on.
Exactly. And now if I see a television, you can't talk to me because if the TV is on, I'm completely glued to it. Whereas my friends who were sat in front of the TV at age 4 or whatever, they don't need to look at a TV now.
Oh, you think they're immunized?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, something like that. I mean, I just think that, like, you know,
France, they make the kids drink wine so that way they don't become drunks.
There you go. There you go. And I do think that there's like a little bit of both happening here, right? Like I do think that this point about what Facebook and a lot of these other applications and I would argue sometimes media companies, even though they don't want to call themselves that, right, are doing is they are competing for your time. And to do that, they do kind of try to increase this randomly reinforced behavior where you engage with the platform over and over and over again on this kind of random basis. And that sort of trains you to behave that way.
It's a Skinner box. It's a Skinner box.
Totally.
We're getting our pellets, our food pellets, pressing the pedal.
Totally.
Those are those dopamine hits. And, you know, I mean, it's video games do it too. I mean, it's, you know, I've seen people talk about, we've talked about World of Warcraft and how finely tuned those raids are to give you exactly the right loot, the time the loot drops just right so that you can't stop. You got to do it again. And there are people who've actually injured themselves by playing World of Warcraft without stopping.
Oh, and that stuff is lightweight to work compared to what they're doing now, but that's
old
school.
That's the OG. That's the OG dopamine.
The most embarrassing admission ever. I injured myself playing World of Warcraft.
I took an arrow to the knee. actually, there was a really interesting piece on Morning Edition on NPR. Speaking of NPR, Ben, are you safe for my kids? And it talks a little bit about privacy. I'm going to skip the privacy thing to go right to the questions. And they're talking to a couple of child psychologists about how kids relate. Apparently, a lot of parents let their kids talk to Amazon's Echo or Google Home to ask questions. Why is the sky blue? Ask Echo. And that's not so bad. In fact, Solis Shen, who's a psychologist at Cornell, says, in a way, these devices are great for kids. They can learn a lot from the devices without parents having to bring out their phones or computers. But, and they interview also Rachel Severson, who's a child psychologist at the University of Montana. There are some concerns that kids are very bossy with these devices and that they might be learning to be rude. And you might say, well, they can tell the difference between an Echo and a human, but maybe they can't. They talk to 1 4-year-old who thinks the Echo is a person who lives in an apartment outside his window. A person.
I mean, you're dealing with levels of kids who are still believing in things like Santa Claus. Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Wait a minute. What?
And there's there are studies that really talk about child psychology in terms of understanding what is real and what is not, which is why television is encouraged to come in at a later point so that when a kid looks at a TV screen, understands, no, that's not a real person. And computer use and iPad use is also studied in that same way of, okay, there's tactility and there's some of that functionality in terms of learning about computer systems. But your brain is also just trying to understand what's real and what is not. And I think talking to an automatic robot like that is not going to have a clear cut, this is great for kids or this is terrible for kids kind of thing. I do have to remind grownups that it's not really a person. If I'm just like, I'll just say, you know, just hello and shut up, and people will get mad.
How could you be so rude?
Yeah.
Well, so here's the question. Do you teach, none of you have kids. Well, Jason, you have kids.
I do.
I have kids, obviously, but my kids are grown. Do you teach young children? There's two ways you could go with this. One, be polite. Please say please and thank you to Echo. Or do you, because you have to be polite. Or
well, none
do you
of the
teach,
services reinforce politeness, by the way. They're all designed solely for commands.
That's part of the problem, is that kids are yelling at this device and the device is completely, you know, okay, fine, whatever you want. Severson says children are developing the conceptions of what's appropriate in social interaction. And so if you want kids to say please and thank you, you probably want to say please and thank you to your Echo. I don't know. I disagree. I think maybe you should say, look, you treat machines one way and this is a machine. One thing that would be really useful to teach people is not to anthropomorphize technology.
Oh, yeah.
Because that leads to trouble.
To do that. Yeah,
this is like a scene out of Blade Runner 2050. Just a parent talking to their child, like, "Listen, we have to have the robot talk."
It is true. Give the robot the talking stick.
All right. I kind of go both ways on this, though, because although it is true, it is a robot. I do find myself wanting to say thank you to Ella, wishing that she would be listening and actually acknowledge that.
But don't you just as often swear at her?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. You know,
I
shut
swear
up, lady.
At Siri,
right?
All the time.
But here's the thing. These are boxes that we talk into, and sometimes there are robots on the other side of these boxes. There are AIs on the other side of these interfaces. Sometimes there are people. So I can see the other side of it, which is to say, once you dehumanize everything that comes through an interface to you, it's easier to dehumanize people on the other side of a social media
that's
interface.
That's a great point.
So that's Mike. Which is worse, right? I think maybe treating the AI like a person and being nice to them is maybe a better way if you're going to err on one side or another than dehumanizing everything that you interact with through a screen.
But you see the consequences of anthropomorphizing technology. People will say, oh, I don't want Google reading my email, as if Google is, you know, there's a human reading my email instead of some algorithm pattern matching a stream of bits.
Yeah, but Google's at fault there too, right? I mean, they've named their assistant Google. They're leaning into it. Yeah. When saying like, yeah, Google, talk to Google.
Is it well, that's another question. Is it better to talk to a Google Home and say, hey, Google, or is it better to talk to a woman named, well, I don't want to say your name out loud because I don't want to trigger the...
Oh, we've done that so much already.
We should have
a little like tone.
I got to send you guys the memo because what we do, what our rule is here, not to say the A word, but to say Echo, because otherwise
Hello, lady.
Hello, lady.
Like say. Lady in the canister.
Hi there. Hi, Ivan. I mean, actually Google and Amazon have taken two different roads on this, haven't they? And now Siri, I don't know if that's a personal name or a Cortana, same thing. Those are more machine names, but Alexa is a human.
Well, also they have and they haven't, right? Because all of the voices are women.
Well, that's
I mean,
true.
You can change them, but their default is a female voice, which is, interesting and strange.
Female everywhere. In the UK, I think Siri defaults to a male voice. So it's just in the US we've decided.
But, and you can easily change it. You can easily change it. In fact, I changed my Siri to a guy.
But it is strange that that's the default. I mean, I think there's something somewhat problematic in that design as well. Right.
I mean, that's just research pointing to how, at least in Western culture, people respond to gendered voices differently. And that's why a lot of subway and public transit systems err on the side of woman voices. In Seattle, they have a completely robotically generated voice for the announcements on the light rail train that runs from the airport the way to the, University of Washington.
Does it bother you that it's a robot?
Well, they did that just to save money. It sounds just like a person. They just didn't want to pay royalties.
Oh.
The New York subway guy works at Bloomberg, by the way.
Really?
I forget his name, but yeah.
He's not a professional announcer. He's not.
He works at Bloomberg. So you can get, if you go there, you can get him to say, stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Oh my God. Can't wait for that new ringtone.
The You've Got Mail guy, what was his name? Durwood? He wasn't a professional, but then he made a living for a while. I don't know what he's doing these days. Recording. I got him to record. It was like $50. You've got mail, you twit. I wish I could find it, but he would do that. He would do custom You've Got Mail recordings for people.
That's good.
Man, I feel bad about that $50.
But I think I do. I feel he asked me where my Bitcoin is. I have 7 Bitcoins. That's nothing. I can't figure out where it is. Steve Gibson. Early on, our security guy ran a Bitcoin mining thing just to see what happened, and 50 coins fell out, which today would be worth, $350,000, something? And he doesn't know where his wallet is.
Oh, no.
It's very easy to misplace Bitcoin.
Should ask his Echo.
That's a lot of money to lose. Yeah, Echo, where the hell's my Bitcoin?
I've got some real-time follow-up. The voice of the New York subway does work at Bloomberg, but he's a radio guy. He's Bloomberg radio news anchor, so that makes sense.
Oh, okay. That's different.
Yeah.
So, you know, they got some real pipes for the – I like that because in the Bay Area, BART used to have the actual train conductors do the announcements, and I couldn't understand a word they were saying because they're in the line of train compartment. Like,
you get that on the subway, too. When you're on the train
– pre-recorded is the way.
I hate it. Where
mind the gap?
Where are we? Wait a minute. I want to hear. I got to hear some subway announcements here. Now. Okay. Here we go. Here's just so you know what it sounds like.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
That's Charlie Pellet.
There it is.
Charlie Pellet.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Bloomberg radio reporter. The most
also, that was a little bit of trivia about you, Leo. We know that you enable autoplay on YouTube. You're that guy. I was wondering who did that.
What, you can turn it off?
Yes. Oh, it's a little button.
Ladies and gentlemen, we apologize for the unavoidable delay. I'm a friendly guy. I mean it in a nice way. I'm sorry if you're stuck in a train. I literally share your pain because I'm probably on that same train wondering, am I going to get to work on time?
That's Charlie Pellet. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to do that. I'll do it for free. Any city that needs somebody.
You should be the voice of the smart train, Leo.
I'll do Marty. I like Marty. Hey, did y'all use your 50 character Twitter handle? Did you use it up?
Oh, yeah.
I saw yours. Yours was good.
Well, I feel guilty about it. I said something like Leo Laporte, chief twit and the tech guy. I mean, it's probably I feel like I should do that. So if you know that's who that is.
Mine is a bit of a statement about Twitter's policies. You're welcome to load it up and read it out loud if you want.
Oh, Twitter.com at SamRed. Let's see. Because SamRed's nice and short, by the way. I like that. Twitter has too many misogynazis. That's COVID.
Because lesson I learned was that they don't let you use the word Twitter in your username. So I used a different character.
Using the CNET bar. So that's interesting. I do think that that's one thing that's going to happen is a lot of people are going to use those longer handles for, you know, timely announcements. In fact, I might change mine to Mind the Gap or something.
I think it's that you can use emoji a little more effectively because of the number of characters that they occupy by default.
And if you're using an iPhone and you type I and you get a question mark, it won't penalize you.
Right.
You all saw the I hate Notre Dame joke, right? It was yesterday, college football. Let me see if I can find it. They punked Apple. This was the autocorrect. Let me see if I can find it. The autocorrect, you know, the problem that the iPhone had briefly.
Yeah, there was some weird, it turns out, like machine learning trending, and it got kind of corrupted. And so they ended up with this weird, like, non-printable, non-emoji, zero space thing. Jeremy Burge wrote about it on Emojipedia. They seem to have fixed it in the latest update, but it's weird because it was a strange interaction with their smart autocorrect that got really stupid really fast.
Speaking of lengthy Twitter handles, what about 280 characters? Where does the panel stand on that? Pro, con, what do you think?
I'm finding that I'm trying to reduce to 140 whenever possible because I think we all are workers of the written word and understand that brevity really does add something.
I like the concision of 140 characters. Yeah. I miss it a little bit.
Like I kind of like 160, or I like to be have 140 and a link. One thing is I like to have that tiny bit of cushion and the ability to have a link or other longer text that would crowd out. I'd like to have that full 140 and a relevant link or something like that. And so that is maybe the more beneficial thing. But generally, it's just people are really excited to not shorten words and to add passive voice and other stuff that drives me insane. Mm. So that's where I come down. I don't think it's making it a smarter platform. It may reduce a little bit of the threading kind of thing that's become really huge because Twitter really, really began supporting threading as a clickable, usable thing in the past year, I'd say. And now you can kind of reduce down and get stuff into less of a thread, but I still think threading ultimately lets you be a little bit more like a beat poet. You bam a little bit, and you kind of have that cadence. And I don't think 280 helps that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes – I think Twitter made – at least it made me a better writer, I feel like. Well, and, you know, it just – it made me a little bit more direct with the things that I wanted to say on the platform. And I think 280 – I mean, again, I don't want to get in. I don't know if I would get into like finding that, like, oh, it's 160. That's the perfect amount. But I do think it 280 is, it feels like too much to me. I don't know.
Yeah. I did see somebody complaining about the 280 limit in a thread that went on for 20 tweets. And I thought, now, wait a second. You should probably, there's something wrong with that. But as somebody who, you know, I do a lot of stuff with podcasting and sometimes with writing where I'm like citing people and like when I do a podcast with five people and I try to mention them all, I like literally run out of room to explain what we talked about. I just say podcast names done. So having that room for stuff like that is fine. But I find when I'm writing them this last week when I've been writing them because all of my clients got updated to support 280, I get really antsy after about 140 and sort of like, you know, I'd rather keep it short and keep it pithy. And the question is, how long will that training last? Because having the constraint has been great. There are moments where it gets frustrating, but you know, it's like writing a haiku or something. It's a word game that you play mentally. Like, how can I get this message compacted into this small amount of space? And I will miss that, but I won't miss having to thread posts because I can't name everybody who was on my podcast in one tweet.
Well, that would be the responsible way to use it, to be concise whenever possible, when necessary, use the extra. And actually, what's interesting, that's kind of seems to be what happened. When it first was expanded to 280, it was horrific. It was just everybody was over-tweeting.
Yeah. Everybody was happy to hit that enter key as well. It's like, let's see how much we can stretch this on your desktop
screen. All the way down
the
page, and now I think it's settled down. And actually, most people's tweets are back to their original length, but I think when necessary, you've got a little bit more. I like that.
I just remembered one really cool thing I did get to do was I didn't have to shorten a really interesting quote. And I think sometimes people have something to say from a different perspective that is really hard to bring down to 140. It was Ta-Nehisi Coates was talking about white hip hop fans being sad that they can't say every word in a song that they like and why. And his insight was, you know, being a hip hop fan, not being able to use the N-word is very insightful. It will give you just a little peek into the world of what it means to be black.
Oh,
to be black is to walk through the world and watch people do things that you cannot do. Now, that whole quote, I think, says a lot, and shortening it loses a little bit of the impact. And there's way more that he says in the video. But I had an opportunity to take that entire chain of thought, which is really short compared to all the context he gives, and sell that video. And Twitter tells me that this was engaged with a lot. People were able to see that full quote and go, oh, I'm going to look at the world in a different way. And that to me is the best thing about the terrible garbage dumpster fire that is Twitter, is sometimes it opens us up to different perspectives in a really cool way. So if 280 got me there, I'll take it.
But wait, couldn't you have just screenshot it?
Yes, I could have.
That's cheesy. I kind of prefer to have it in the tweet, right? I don't like the big images. By the way, Ben has already changed his Twitter handle to Ben Stand Clear of the Closing Doors, Brock Johnson. Nice. Well done, Ben. Well done. You wasted no time.
And the video viewers get to see a really swell GIF/GIF right there.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, that's what that's your pinned tweet. But it kind of fits the handle. All right.
Definitely stand clear of those closing doors.
Stand clear of the closing doors and whatever displays there might be up there. One last Twitter story, kind of a little more serious story. Twitter has paused account verifications because it got a lot of heat for verifying a white supremacist, the organizer of the Charlottesville rally.
Yeah.
I think that's unfortunate because I think if this is that guy, you want to see that blue check to know it's him.
Yeah, Twitter needs to decide what verification is. I think this is the problem, is that they've vacillated between that it's sort
it's
of like
a
an
reward.
Endorsement.
Is it a reward?
That it's, well, originally it was like only members of the media, and there was this idea that it maybe was sort of a reward. And I definitely got verified at one point because I was at a big enough editorial organization that they verified me. I feel like it would be better if they just said, look, everybody can be verified, because what all verified means is that, yes, it is this person. It's not a parody account. It's not a fake. We know it's this person, because that was, I think that was the original intent, was you were just trying to, the check mark meant it wasn't a joke account or a fake account or somebody posing as this person from a slightly different address. But what's happened is it's got a status attached to it. And I think Twitter needs to move past that. But of course, this is also just, you know, should white supremacists be on Twitter's platform regardless? I think this just is salt in the wound of that.
I will
Twitter's
say
Twitter's favorite state of policy being is vacillation. That's what Twitter loves to do. But it's also I totally agree. I think that Twitter, look, to a certain degree, the way I always looked at verification is even to a certain degree, it wasn't like, oh, this person is legit, but more like this person is a they are a personality on Twitter that is known, and they are who they say they are. And if Twitter would just like come out and say that instead of getting freaked out and reversing course, I think that would do really well for the platform if they just like said, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. Take a position. Stop just freaking out.
One of the big reasons the checkmark really came in was because Twitter wanted very badly to have celebrities hooked on their phones popping in with those 140-character tweets. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal was one of the early guys that got people excited about Twitter because he could just grab his phone, interact with a ton of fans, and people knew it was Shaq. They knew it wasn't some fake account like other platforms like MySpace had been flooded with. And from there, the blue check mark started rolling out to media after that. And my belief, and no one's ever said it, is that they wanted to butter our bread. that they gave us this blue check mark. Nobody is pretending to be Sam Moskovich on Twitter. If they do, they're not going to really get a payoff. Bad news, y'all. But now, you know, you look on and the comment about verification as a wider idea, a wider concept to me would be, you know, what could be more timely to talk about? Like, so right now I checked Twitter and I got a response for this twit.tv appearance that I mentioned. The response was from what appears to be a troll farm account, and it complimented me. And what it wanted me to do was hit like on it because it's trying to accrue those likes, because that is how Twitter verifies accounts in general, is that it is using the hive mind to say, oh, we're liking, we're retweeting. Jack Trenton himself got busted retweeting a troll farm, which is what we found out a few weeks ago. So long as that is the currency of quote unquote verification, Twitter is in the toilet in terms of being a truly relatable and understandable platform. So the blue check mark has this extra weird weight and currency. Milo Yiannopoulos's banning from the check mark, you know, downgrading from that before he was kicked off all the way, I think that sent the clearest signal of all.
Yeah, it was the wrong message.
Because, yeah, either the blue check mark is about free speech and about all these different voices, as opposed to this is a it confers benefits. We get, if you're blue check marked, you get these extra filters, you get extra attention from the support staff. It goes a long way. So I think it's just a major symptom of a really big problem for us to trust Twitter as a truly democratic platform of speech.
Well said. Let's take a break. Go get your cigs and light up. The smoking lamp is on because we're going to take a little bit of a break and watch movies, because we have created a special highlight reel from this week's amazing Twit shows. Watch.
Previously on Twit.
It's the end of daylight savings, as you can see. There's no daylight in my house whatsoever.
It's dark in your house. It's
dark and dreary.
Yep.
And I'm Florence Ion.
Wow. Melodramatic flow.
Know-how.
Today on Know-How,
we'll show you how to shut your pie hole.
We're going to take a Raspberry Pi and use it to block ads. If you have a Raspberry Pi 2 sitting around, or maybe even a Raspberry Pi 3, this is a very cool project that's incredibly quick to do that you can start playing with to see if you want to get some ad-blocking bliss.
The new screensavers.
A lot of folks in tech these days say they're doing what they're doing to save lives and make the world a better place, but Gitanjali Rao really is, and she's only 11 years old.
Yeah, so I developed a device to detect lead in water faster than the current techniques out there today. It's pretty much just a blue box with a white cartridge, and you just have to dip the cartridge in the water you wish to test.
So you coded the app all by yourself?
Yes, I did. I used the application called the MIT App Inventor software, and this allowed me to use a drag and drop code, give you the status of slightly contaminated, safe, or critical according to your water status.
Twit. Line 10, print I love Twit. Line 20, go to line 10.
Oh my goodness.
What were you like at 11?
I was not like that.
No.
Oh, that's the first time we've ever had code in our Twit promo. She was amazing, wasn't she? The 11-year-old genius. That was a fascinating interview. You got to see it on the new screensavers. Our show today. Let me do this and then we'll send along some congratulations to a good friend. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. If you're ready to buy a home or refi a home, I want to point you in the right direction. Not only to the best lender in the country, Quicken Loans, one of the biggest, I think $92 billion in loans, but also one of the best, number one in customer satisfaction, 7 years in a row by J.D. Power. So that's a good sign. People love Quicken Loans. And I love them even more because now they've made the mortgage process completely online. So simple. No more going to a bank hat in hand to get a loan. No more going to the attic to get bank statements or pay stubs. You can do it all on your smartphone. So fast, too, that you could do it at an open house and be approved before you leave. Now, that is awesome. All you need to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Two, they'll ask you a couple of questions. Because they have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions, all you have to do is say, yeah, that's me. Yeah, you can look at my bank statement. And then they will crunch the numbers. No paperwork. You don't have to fax them anything. Based on income, assets, and credits, they'll analyze all your home loan options. You get to choose the down payment, the rate, and the term. And you'll Get the loan that's right for you and be approved. Not in weeks or days, but in minutes. Minutes. It's instant. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. You may not be buying a house today, but, you know, bookmark that so you'll have it ready when you do. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/twit, and the number 2. Congratulations, Kevin Rose and Daria Rose had a baby. Kevin, of course, a regular on this show from the very first, and a founder, creator of Dig. He went to Google Ventures. He's a watch guy. He's got a new app. Actually, he's got two babies because his new app is a fabulous meditation app on iOS called Oak. And about a week later, Zelda Lynn Rose was born on November 8th, 7 pounds, 9 ounces. His wife, Daria, and baby Zelda are doing great, he says. And he on Instagram, he mentioned, fun fact, Daria played over 200 hours of the new Zelda on her Switch during pregnancy. I don't know if that's why they named her Zelda, but I think, Sam, you can identify, right?
I think there are going to be a lot of children named Zelda in the next 20 years. You're going to have some teacher call out for Zelda, and boop, boop. Zelda? And then you're going to have one kid who be like, Link is the hero. And then it's the whole thing.
And that kid's name will be Link. Let's just be clear.
His name will be Link. Yeah. Yeah. It's better than the Break of the Wind or whatever the name of that was.
Breath of the Wild.
Break of the Wind. I don't know. Whatever.
It's a little known mini game. Yeah.
I was watching somebody play that game on the plane today, and it was really interesting to think about how Nintendo has chosen this game that fundamentally, for the Switch, that is fundamentally a lonesome game. It feels like a lonesome game.
Yeah, you're wandering.
Well, everything about it was built for the Wii U. He carries a Wii U controller in the entire game, and at the last minute they had to restyle it to look less like the Wii U and more like the Switch, because it's this tablet that magically shows information while he's on his adventure, which was the whole point of the Wii U, that it had this extra screen. And so it was a weird fit. I mean, obviously it's awesome to play on a plane and also awesome to watch someone else play it. I've totally done that, but you know, Mario Odyssey.
But it is kind of lonely, right? It's not. This is the era of games that are much more social than that, right? I don't know. I just
Mario Odyssey is a way more joyous, interacting with other people very quickly kind of thing. It's just there's always people to talk to and stuff to do. And that is easily the loneliest of the Zelda games. Not as much music, not as many townspeople. It's sadder. It's darker. It's a really cool game. But yeah, it doesn't quite fit into that Switch paradigm. You're not having a rooftop party with Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, nor are you storming Normandy Beach during D-Day. Call of Duty, a very crowded game, maybe a little too crowded. Launch title for the Xbox One X, $500 million in its first 3 days of release. Take that, Hollywood.
Yeah.
That is mind-boggling. Wow. Sam, how much does it cost to make a title like that? 100, 200 million?
The budgets are just going up and up, especially when these companies think that they can attach continued payments on top, whether it's an expansion pass or paying for random in-game items, the practice of loot boxes. And Call of Duty World War II follows other games in this suit. So the budgets are going up, especially when you have multiple studios working on these games. So Activision has this rolling program to have three different major studios, each making a Call of Duty game, each taking 3 years to make it. The idea being that they don't want to make it feel like the games are rushed. So they just like, we have the budget, we keep selling them, so you get 3 years, go. And then on top of that, they have other support studios that make the other bits. So maybe they're contracting for the multiplayer battle maps as opposed to single player. Or maybe they're contracting for the co-op and kill zombies mode, which all of these games happen to have now.
Yeah, so the zombies, very fun, but scary.
Yeah, so they the the budgets are really huge. And this is impressive that they've been able to crack that much in sales, because it is very crowded in games right now in AAA. If you load up Steam on PC, for example, it's, I feel like there's 12 games a minute because of lax standards in terms of releasing. Yeah. And PlayStation 4 and Xbox One have been embracing that as well. It's been just very busy for giant shooting games, let alone just for giant epic games. I mean, this October and November, we've just been struggling to play them all. And the fact that any game can still break out and sell that much is pretty monumental. So especially this Call of Duty didn't really get reviewed incredibly well. They just said, yeah, they're returning to the old well. They're not returning to some of the facets of the series that made it interesting in the old days. You know, stepping back in time with World War II didn't also mean stepping forward with significantly more interesting or fun or compelling story or gameplay or things like that. But people still want to do Call of Duty with their friends. It's still happening. And so Activision is going to continue beating that drum and paying a lot of people a lot of money to keep making it. That may dry up. You know, they're the company that rode Guitar Hero into destruction. That was a series that was huge, and it came out every year, and everyone said, we're done with the plastic guitars, but they're not done shooting other kids on the internet in the face.
I still can't get off Omaha Beach, though. I don't know what I'm doing wrong on the single player.
The opening. I think it would have been compelling if the game actually just made you die over and over in the Normandy mission, and that was the game. The game would be just this terrible, dark statement about war, that it was unbeatable, and that was what
you're
going to
lose, and you're
going to
die. Oh, that that's Player Unknown's Battlegrounds. You got that's a different game. Yeah.
Oh, that one's you'll get your chicken dinner someday, Leo. I swear. You just got to. I'll be your Sherpa along the Eastern European battleground.
So the interesting thing about this comes out on the Xbox One 10 in end of the year.
All Xboxes. It'll be on all Xboxes.
It's a PC game now only, right?
Correct. And it's a kind of a broken PC game. It's continued to be early access, kind of buggy. But the promise that they're making is that the quote-unquote 1.0 version will be out on PC by the end of the year, and that the early access Xbox version will also be out in December. So, I mean, good luck. They've got Microsoft has really jumped in to help make this, because Xbox needs a big exclusive.
They don't have one. Yeah.
They've had some major cancellations. They were going to have Crackdown 3, which was this continuation of a Grand Theft Auto-styled superhero game. So they had to delay that. They had an epic sword and battling game called Scalebound. They canceled that. They put out a bunch of Kinect ports that had been out on the old Xbox 360 Kinect, Disney kind of stuff. That's what they did to fill the gap. It's kind of as awesome as the Xbox One X is, and we can get to that if you want. They really need something huge. And PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds cannot stop selling. Not only are people buying it, but they're playing it. This is huge for a $40 game, because we've all heard that you can't release a game that costs money and sell a bunch, especially if you're small and indie. You have to go free to play, or a small fee, or extra microtransaction stuff. You buy that for $30, and people are buying it all over the world in markets where people don't necessarily pay for full price games. So it's working. It's making money. And, you know, it's going to make money on Xbox no matter how buggy it is, because the PC one's been funky and it's doing great.
I'm just waiting until it comes out on Xbox. That's when I'm going to get it. I don't have a PC to play it. Xbox One 10. It's good, right? You like it, Sam?
The Xbox One X is good. Okay.
Is it good enough to beat PlayStation 4 Pro?
A little bit. So this is really true. But this is
a little
tricky
bit.
A little bit. By a dollar.
Because Microsoft has not come out and giving us a spreadsheet of saying, this is exactly how much better every game is. This is exactly what you're going to get in every game. There is a Xbox One X enhanced list. So when you go on the store, it'll say, these are the games that have been patched. You can go on a website, and that's a further list of what will get patches and some minor descriptions. So some will say 4K, meaning they're really running at 3840 by 2160, that UHD spec of resolution, which is 4x 1080p. So that's a pretty tremendous resolution, and I've seen that in action on Xbox One X. It is phenomenal if you have your room set up in such a way that you look at a screen and go, I notice a difference.
I'm only about 8 feet away from it. It's a 70-inch screen. It fills my view. And playing Assassin's Creed Origin, not a great game, but I feel like I'm in Egypt.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it's sharp. But if you're just that little bit further away because you're on the couch,
right,
you're really, those, some of those bonuses and perks don't pop up. And it's right. Also, some of these games have optimizations. And when we go in and test, we find, oh, wait, we're getting some stuttering. We're getting some not optimized stuff, which was the same issue with PlayStation 4 Pro when it first came out. And those issues have kind of mellowed out. That system, it runs sort of more efficiently. You get what they advertise, which is usually closer to 1440p or 1800p. They're not going full 4K, and they've always said that, because what the problem with both of these systems from a super geek perspective is that they rely on a crappy AMD architecture called Jaguar. It was designed to not overheat because nobody wanted another Xbox 360 Red Ring situation. So they said, we're going to lower the clock speeds but have 8 cores, and that's going to work great. And every game developer in the world said, what are you doing? When we make stuff in x86 or x64, we want higher clock speed, not this multi-threaded crap. It just doesn't work for what games demand in terms of
AI. It doesn't benefit frame rate. You can't speed up frame rate with 8 cores.
And you can't even do other fun, interesting, futuristic stuff like more sophisticated AI. Call of Duty guys are still idiots because you're trying to make it look really good. Yeah, they're going to be dumb. You're kind of narrowing down. So neither system is going to push that threshold further. You're ultimately still playing games that are designed for Jaguar and its limitations. This is not a new generation. This is just a way to say, well, if you want to stay in this generation, we'll just make it look a little better on your TV. In some ways, hugely. In other ways, somewhat. So for $500, this is an awesome proposition for power. But it's also not what you might think of $500 as, a new wave of, oh my goodness, games really are doing something different this generation.
And actually,
can I ask a question about this,
learned,
though?
Hold one second. As we learned last time, $100, which I wouldn't have thought would make a difference, makes a huge difference in console gaming. That's why PlayStation dominated Microsoft in the last round.
They charged $100 more for the Kinect. Yeah, that didn't work. Now they're charging $100 more for more power. So I think both systems are good. They both sell something that looks better on a 4K TV than the stock PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. That's a given. And at this point, really, it does boil down to, what do you already own games for? Do you have a bunch of PlayStation games? I would not tell you to switch. If you own a bunch of Xbox, same thing. Right. And if you're somehow coming into this fresh, then yes, I would say Xbox One X all in all is slightly better. But like I said, some big cancellations, some lacking in genres. You don't get Halo or Gears of War on PlayStation, and you don't get a lot of cool Sony games on Xbox.
Don't get Uncharted on
that. This just feels like a really long way of saying both systems are good, though. I mean, I as a weekend warrior, I feel like it sounds to me like this stuff is incremental, almost in the same way that smartphones are incremental now. Like,
absolutely.
If you're already in a certain ecosystem, then sticking that ecosystem is just as good as the other ecosystem.
The difference is the time frame for consoles is years instead of every year.
True.
And
true.
So, you know, you're getting incremental improvement, and from 5 years ago,
I don't know. That's a big deal. Yeah.
And ultimately, both companies want to make it so when you buy their product, whatever you owned will continue to work. Right. That is sort of the promise. They're trying to make it more like smartphones. But again, that Jaguar architecture is the thing that keeps games not quite doing the wow stuff that we really are hoping for when we want to say one is better than the other. They're both locked into that.
Both these companies are saying the next generation is virtual reality anyway, so why put more energy into this?
I mean, if they come out with headsets that aren't weird, that don't isolate, that feel comfortable. I mean, I got to try out Oculus's Santa Cruz prototype, which has a powerful processor in the headset and no cords. And even that is still kind of limiting. You're not able to share that in the living room with other people. It's getting closer, but VR, it's good, but there are enough roadblocks in the consumer experience, in the Best Buy styled experience. I mean, go into any Best Buy, if they even have an Oculus demo station still, they're collecting dust. People have not shown that interest.
I use my PSVR all the time. I love my PlayStation VR. You just have to clear the floor.
I love VR, and when VR is great, it is really good. But we're going to see 3 big VR games, all from Bethesda, coming in the next 31 days. We've got Doom, Elder Scrolls Skyrim, and Fallout.
Wait a minute. Doom in VR? That's going to be
horrible.
And I've got Well, I've gotten to test them all. Doom is the most, actually the smoothest, which is insane because you're moving really fast and killing things left and right. But the other ones, the RPGs,
I'm feeling queasy just thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I go to Puketon, Massachusetts whenever I do anything that crazy, and I could handle it. But the RPGs were actually clumsier, at least in preview form. And I think these are going to be really telling. We're going to see how people respond to those. I think everyone is going to look at those sales and how people respond in terms of comfort and enjoyment and go from there. Because if those three huge games don't move the needle in VR, then that's going to tell a lot of people to tap the brakes.
All right. A little palate cleanser. This is from Jason Snell.
Oh, no.
Are you getting my audio?
Con bloodsucker. You're going to have to do your own dirty work now.
Now, if you're only listening to the audio, you're not seeing the talking chicken and fox.
Kirk. Kirk, you're still alive.
How many times did you have to do this?
Still.
It's one take, man.
Friend.
You know it that well?
Yeah. You've seen that movie 50, 60 times. Else, easy. Poor
marksman. It's hard to do that.
Missing the target.
James Kirk cadence, though. You did that quite well.
I grew up watching Star Trek every night at 5 o'clock on Channel 2, and so I Captain Kirk is part of
Bill Shatner. Cadence is hard to do because everything is so unexpected.
You just have to pause from time to time.
But there's no rhyme or reason as to how long he pauses for.
Khan, you've got Genesis. You are going to kill me, Khan. You're going to have to come down here.
Nice. Very well done.
I've done far worse than kill you.
Uh-oh.
I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you.
Okay. Enough. That is, you can find more about that.
Khan is a chicken.
Khan is a chicken. I'm sure that's at the end. I stopped.
Yes, that is at the end.
I stopped too soon, but I'll leave that as an exercise for the. if you're listening, you're missing all the fun. That's Animoji.
Yeah,
which thank God died out.
It's a chicken and a fox. So it's not. It's not. We'll see. I think we're gonna get a whole other wave of Animoji, and it's never gonna die. But it's also, I think we've probably seen its peak.
Bill Gates.
Well, it's got that glitchy sort of stuff, and people on the internet love when things don't quite, when the uncanny valley shows up in really weird ways. I mean, even in that clip, you had a little bit of eye twitchiness. So
yeah, I wonder what I was doing to get the eye twitched. Yeah.
Bill Gates buys a big chunk of land, $80 million to start a community 45 minutes west of Phoenix, 25,000 acres. He's calling it Belmart. It will be a city of the future. If you want to move there, 3,800 acres will go to office, commercial, and retail space, 470 acres for public schools, room for 80,000 residential units. Unfortunately, Bill's a smart guy, but a former Phoenix newspaper columnist said, Bill, there's not going to be any water here in about 4 years. You can't put in a town of 80,000 people. Where's the water coming from?
Well, maybe that's something the Gates Foundation is working on. Maybe, and what better way to show that off?
Yeah, maybe they'll solve that somehow. Let's see. Oh, I should mention this Bob Lutz article. The chat room's been talking about it. Bob Lutz, well-known in the motoring. He's the former vice chairman and head of product development at General Motors. He's worked at Ford, Chrysler, BMW, and Opel. He says, kiss the good times goodbye. It saddens me to say it, but we're approaching the end of the automotive era. Everyone will have 5 years to get their car off the road or sell it for scraps. CNBC says, asked him about a study showing people don't want to buy autonomous cars because they're scared of it. He says, we don't need public acceptance of autonomous vehicles. At first, all we need is acceptance by big fleets, Uber, Lyft, FedEx, UPS, the Postal Service, utility companies, delivery services. Amazon will buy a slew of them. These fleet owners will account for several million vehicles a year. Every month, they'll order 100,000 low-end modules, 100,000 medium, 100,000 high-end. The low-cost provider that delivers a spec will get the business. They won't be branded Chevrolet or Ford or Toyota. They'll be branded Lyft or Uber. And
yeah, this is the speculation about the Apple car is the similar thing, that in the end it won't be something that people buy.
It'll be fleets
and a service.
Yeah.
He says multimodal.
He says it's the demise of automotive retailing as we know it. He says, think about it. A horse dealer had a stable of horses of all ages. You'd come in, get the horses suited you. You trade in your old horse, take a new horse home. Car dealers would continue to exist, but only as a fringe business.
I think he's not wrong, except for his time scale, which is completely
pretty quick.
Ludicrous.
Yeah.
Well, you hear, but I feel like you always hear, you hear both ends of the spectrum on this, right? You hear a lot of people being like, 20 years, 30 years. And then you have people being like 3 years. And I just feel like it's always going to be somewhere in the middle. It's going to be like 15 years, right?
I mean, what are the results really in terms of level 5 automation at this point? I know that we've got Waymo having its own driverless cars roaming the streets of Chandler, very close to Phoenix. Yeah.
No safety drivers.
With actually no drivers.
Yeah.
Right? I just don't know. I feel a little, because I'm not the car specialist over at Ars Technica, I just don't know what we're really sure about in terms of truly dependable level 5 automation, because there are a lot of people who say that that has been bandied about to sell people on the prospect and to get the money flowing so that level 5 automation will actually be paid for. That, like, let's get the money flowing and then we'll get there. We swear, we promise, we'll make this timeline. And if that's proven wrong, then great, good for the smart people designing this stuff. But what I've sort of gathered from people who are a little more skeptical and who know their stuff is, well, is it the money first and then the automation? Are we really going to be there? Or is this just a lot of hot air just to get money puffed in for those edge cases that really matter? Because if you want to go level 5, you can't have a single slip up. It's just period, bar none.
Well, you can't have a single slip up.
You can have a single slip up, but the challenge is you got to be safer than a human. And that's going to be really hard. I don't believe that this is stuff that is impossible, though. I mean, I think that all the tech to do this exists. It's not like we have a cloud with a question mark in it, and it's like, well, I don't know how we're going to invent that. It's sensors and software. But, you know, it is going to take time. And I think that there is this danger that Elon Musk and maybe Ford with their level 4 by 2020 kind of stuff is kind of overselling how quickly this is going to come. And the danger there is they might get more money by overselling it, but you risk turning the public off to being promised something that they couldn't deliver in time.
Well, but I guess that's Lutz's point, is it doesn't matter what the public thinks, because there's such a huge economy for these big fleets that they'll do it anyway.
As soon as it's profitable to do it, right? And that's the challenge, is if they can get an autonomous fleet up and running for Uber and Lyft to use, then sold, right? But it has to be economical for them to do that, which means that the cost of the hardware and the versus paying the drivers, and I mean, all of that gets factored in. But I do think that he's right. I think it's just a matter of, as we've been saying here, 5 years seems kind of ludicrous, but 10 or 15?
Yeah. You know, all the technologies are longer than you think, but are faster than you think, longer than you want, or something like that.
There's increments, right? We're just not. I feel like we haven't even entered the space where there are lots of autonomous vehicles in the wild. I like that. I can see it. Once that starts to happen, you know, it'll creep in, and then there'll be a tipping point.
It took 10 years for smartphones to get to where they are today. So,
Mike. Right. My concern is that we're talking about ultimately something that is kind of a public works issue in terms of mass transit. And we're not, it's only private enterprise that seems to be leading this. And what happens when private enterprise takes the lead on a huge socially impacting thing? They'll leave it behind when they find something better. They'll leave it behind when something goes bankrupt. And so I just worry. I mean, I just look down. Seattle's kind of crazy when it comes to trying and failing to adopt things. We did, you know, docked bike sharing, and that left us just in the hole because private enterprise said, never mind, we're out. And I'm not saying that's going to happen right now, but as we go in the 5, 10, 15 year timelines, keep an eye on how city councils and governments get involved, if they do, whether rolling out public transit stuff, collaborating with private enterprise in terms of these fleets are going to be driving through our cities, and on and on and on.
Well, and imagine the disruption this causes to the economy, both good and ill, the 1.5% of the workforce that drives for a living. I mean, this is all of this is kind of earth shattering. Speaking of earth shattering, Alibaba's single day record for sales was 11/11, was yesterday. That's Singles Day in China. One day, one merchant, although they have multiple sites, $25 billion in sales.
Did you put your pinky on your lips when you said that?
$25 billion in sales, $8 billion in the first hour. Mind-boggling. And
we've been looking at this for years, or for years on Marketplace Tech when sure. I was hosting Marketplace Tech, and it was really just interesting to see this shopping day blow past Amazon Prime Day, and just it's been amazing to watch it balloon just even over the past several years, right? And what's weird to me is it's this it appears to be this kind of like combination of like Black Friday and the Super Bowl. Like they're creating this huge, like almost cultural behavior all at once. Like yeah. everybody's doing something all at the same time. And it's, I don't know, it's weird to me. And it's just hard to wrap your head around like what is actually being bought on a day like this, obviously, because there's so much of
what
it.
What could you buy? $25 billion.
Yeah,
there's exactly. a lot of DVDs. Now, to put it in perspective, Black Friday last year in the U.S. was $3 billion.
Yeah.
Cyber Monday was $3.5 billion. $25 billion. This is a lot bigger. Nuts.
Yeah.
And that leads to the next story, which is an interesting Bloomberg story that says, get ready, the retail apocalypse in America is just beginning. Brick and mortar stores giving way, not just to Amazon, but the fact that they have outrageous debt, that they've all been leveraged debted with all the buyouts, and you're seeing huge closings all over the country, and it's only going to get worse, which is weird because consumer confidence is up, unemployment is down, stock market is up, retailers collapsing. Of course, Toys R Us, the latest, $6.6 billion, but Payless shoe stores, Source, the Sports Authority, Radio Shack, Borders, Circuit City, big bankruptcies in the last 5-6 years. And this Bloomberg article says many more to come as the debt market.
It's funny that we just talked about self-driving cars and now we're talking about this, right? Because I sort of connect those things in terms of economic disruption. Like one of the things that I always imagine when I think about self-driving cars is the fact that you will order something online and it will come to you in a self-driving car and you will try it on and it won't fit and then you'll throw it back into the self-driving car.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So like, yes. I don't know. It's just interesting to think about these things happening at the same time.
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's all part of the same. But it's dramatic and a transformation of the U.S. economy that nobody's thinking about or preparing for. We're all just enjoying the good times of the stock market.
Well, somebody's thinking about it because when you look at Amazon buying Whole Foods, that's Amazon investing in
Jeff
brick and
Bezos
mortar, right?
is thinking about it.
Yeah,
you better believe it.
That says to me that brick and mortar is still going to exist, but what's going to fall out, and it is going to be devastating, is a lot of really inefficient brick and mortar where I was thinking about like the value of going to Nordstrom and having like a personal shopper kind of walk you around and say, here's a shirt you might like and all of that could compete with something like a clothing box company. I could see that.
But that's why Amazon makes that look, right? I have one of those looks. It judges your outfits. You don't have to leave your closet.
But I think you could argue that there is some value in something like that. But so many of the department stores that are left have cut costs to the point where you're just wandering through racks of clothes. I might as well just shop on Amazon, right? And Whole Foods being connected to Amazon and being able to do deliveries and having stuff, relatively near your house and they can deliver it, maybe in a self-driving car. Like there are arguments for brick and mortar, but the problem is a lot of these retail stores. The service they provide is lousy, and the only thing they've got going for them is that they're in the real world, and you don't have to wait a day or two, and that's going to fall out of the market, and it's going to be devastating. It's true.
Actually, one of Amazon's strategies, it seems, with Whole Foods is to use the brick and mortar for pop-up stores. So they announced this week they're going to open 5 Amazon pop-up stores with Echo speakers, Fire tablets, Prime memberships. They're going to do it in Illinois, Colorado, Michigan, Florida, and California. So I think you could kind of nailed it. Jeff Bezos sees a value to having a storefront, but it is a very different experience.
And that's what the Amazon bookstores have kind of been, which is that the books just collect dust, and people, especially since they require an Amazon Prime membership to get the sales on them, and then you've just got this glut of Amazon hardware devices, and they want those in more people's faces. But ultimately, so long as these service-driven companies fail to compete with a mobile phone as a sales experience driver, they're going to suffer. I mean, what we're just looking at in terms of Alibaba sales, you know, mobile shopping over in China, way higher than here in the States. And that is a number that people are going to be looking at when they say, how can we increase our market share? And that's going to be through how do we get America. I mean, this thing I'm looking at Forbes was saying about 30% of American shoppers used their mobile phones on Prime Day last year. And for Alibaba's Singles Day, 90%. So that is a gap that's going to continue to need, that people are going to look to and get excited about and drool about. How do we get that number up? How do we get the mobile phone use up? And yeah, not necessarily at a store, unless it's like the Amazon shopping automation store where you just tap your phone and then cameras watch you shop, which they still haven't gotten out. I'll be curious to see when that system gets started. Starts get rolling into Whole Foods.
Yeah, that's a good point. The $22.5 billion of that $25 billion was mobile purchases. I mean, just on your phone. Now, of course, culturally, mobile phones are much more popular in Asia. They don't have computers as many and so forth. But that's still, you're buying $22 billion worth of stuff on a phone? What? That's amazing.
Crazy.
Crazy amazing. Talk. All right, let's take a break. We're going to get to the weird stuff. The seeds and the stems in just a minute. The bottom, the shake, the stuff that fell through the hole.
Wow, I didn't know this was happening in Seattle. All right.
Ben Johnson's here. He is from Codebreaker and WBUR in Boston. Great to have you, the Brock Johnson, on the Twitter. Sam Mashkovich from Ars Technica. He's tech cultural editor over there at SamRed. Jason Snell, Six Colors. com and the incomparable at Jay Snell. Our show today brought to you by Tracker. According to Newsweek, we spend, on average, 50 minutes a day looking for stuff we have. We know we have. We just can't find. Like our keys, like our remote controls, like your bicycle, like your briefcase. The Tracker is here to save you finding stuff. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. They've done it again. The new Tracker Pixel is out. I love it. It's smaller. It's lighter. It's ringed with LEDs. So if you know, as often happens, the keys fell down a crack in the sofa, the LEDs and the little sound on it make it very easy. You just press the Tracker app on my phone and it makes my keys beep. And there they are. You can also look on a map on your phone and see the last place that your phone saw the tracker. Now, it's a Bluetooth tracking device. So the idea is your phone pairs with it. You have separation alerts. So if you leave your keys behind, your phone will blare at you. You leave your phone behind, your keys will blare at you. You push a button on the tracker, your phone will start making sound, even if it's silenced. I love that. All in all, it's a very nice, easy-to-use system. But it gets even better when you include the amazing Tracker Crowd Locate Network. It's the largest in the world because there's more than 5 million trackers out there. 8 years, there have been a lot of trackers. That means even if you lose your keys and you walk away and somebody picks them up and takes them somewhere else, anytime anybody with the Tracker app runs or walks by your keys, you'll get a notification on your phone. Hey, I just saw your keys. Here's where they are on the map. That's fantastic. Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you're at absolutely no risk. I want you to visit thetracker.com. T-H is actually the hardest thing to find will be the website because they spell it T-H-E-T-R-A-C-K-R. No E at the end there. .com/twit. Take a look at the Tracker Bravo, the original anodized aluminum. You can engrave it. The new Tracker Pixel. Load up your cart and you'll save 20% off any order. So this is a great stocking stuffer. TheTracker.com/twit. Get some for yourself. Get some for friends, for family. Get some for the holidays. It's inexpensive. Everybody loves getting them. And everybody has something they don't want to lose. Everybody needs the Tracker. T-H-E-T-R-A-C-K-R. TheTracker.com/twit. And when you go there, 20% off any order, even if you've ordered before. So that's a great deal. TheTracker.com/twit for 20% off. And we thank Tracker for their support and for, I use it all the time. I lose my keys a lot. And thank you, Tracker. I never lose them anymore. I don't spend any time looking for them either, which is awesome. Yeah, a few weird stories. Musical.ly acquired for $1 billion. This was all the rage with the Teeny Boppers. It was a social media app that you sing along. 60 million monthly users. I have to think it's at its peak right about now. But a Chinese maker of a news app called Tutayo bought it for as much as $1 billion, making Musical.ly's 30-something CEOs, Alex Zhu and Liu Yang, quite wealthy. Quite wealthy. Nobody here probably records.
I'm trying to remember, what was that app that I want to say that Facebook bought pretty recently that all the kids were using because you could only interact in positive ways? Does anyone remember this?
Yeah, it was an acronym. What was the name of that? Yeah.
As soon as that happened, one of our staffers, Eric Bangeman, reached out to his kids and they said, yeah, no one's using that. It's over. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this app is the same way, but I think that's always the question mark of when you want to acquire something that has that potential of broadening your reach and tapping to young people and having something that lasts for a while. Like, is it going to be using that app? Is it going to be rolling it into a greater service that ultimately adds value and has you compete against the current heavyweights? What's the real goal? I think it ends up being a lot more of the latter of take the good ideas from that, own that patent, move forward. So,
well, the classic, of course, is when Zynga bought OMG Pop, remember, for $200 million.
Yes,
talk about buying high. That was the peak. It was down. It
was not go well.
They wrote the whole thing off. I think Facebook bought, what was it, IYU IHU? I think Facebook bought it because that's Facebook's defense, right? Anything that comes even close, I'm surprised they didn't buy Musical.ly. Anything that comes even close to threatening them, just buy it. You don't care if it's going out of business. You're just protecting yourself. Here's a weird one. Maybe you guys can explain it. Intel has announced they're teaming up with arch rival AMD to create a processor with an Intel CPU and a Radeon GPU inside. Is that surprising?
Not in a world in which smartphone chipsets
are killing them.
Yeah, yep. It's all between ARM and everybody else doing stuff like that. You know, that's a lot of devices that AMD and Intel miss out on. So when it comes to that, you know, it's your DC Marvel sort of thing. When there's a greater superhero to fight above them all, you know.
That's a great analogy. That's exactly what it is.
A lot of speculation that this is tailor-made for Apple stuff, too, because Apple uses these two vendors for these parts.
They don't want to use Qualcomm, right? That's the arch rival. They don't want to use Qualcomm. Apple says, we're not going to use Qualcomm on our next phones.
Yeah, so with this Intel, you know, Intel and AMD, right, the idea here is maybe this is a MacBook, you know, thing, because Apple likes the chipsets from these two vendors, Apple sticks them together now, but if they could be integrated, they would be much more power efficient, and so maybe on the next round of MacBooks or who knows what else. A lot of conspiracy theories about, like, do this, and one of the thoughts was, well, you know what big customer uses both of these products
is Apple.
So maybe that's what's going on in the background.
You could make very super thin and light laptop that had great graphics pretty good graphics performance. That's an interesting I like where you're going with that one, Jason.
It's just, you know, it's Kremlinology, Apple Kremlinology, but it's possible. It's definitely possible.
Yep. Harmony got in a lot of trouble because they announced the end of life of their Link. They're going to close the server March 2018. Everybody who bought a Link said, what? The message went out. Now Logitech says, oh, good news.
Never mind.
We're going to give you a hub. We're shutting the Link down, but we're giving you something better. So it pays to whine, folks.
What is the process to actually get one, though? Do you have to
I think you have to send it back
all the
to
box
them, and then
all the
give
box
you a new
tops
one.
From your favorite cereal.
Get the decoder ring, send
go
it
go to Fry's and get the rebate form.
It just shows you the front page of the internet has some clout. People just went crazy on Reddit.
I think I have a Harmony Hub, and I'm always uneasy about, Logitech because they bought so many different companies that whose products I liked and killed them. But I do think this says something about when you've got service-backed products. I just got a – I tested a bunch of video cameras, like home security cameras a year and a half ago. And I got an email the other day saying, hey, our cloud-backed service for all your video is shutting down next week. Sorry. And that's going to happen. And I think that that's the danger in – I think it's actually going to make products from brands that are recognizable more valuable because you're going to believe that Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, whoever is less likely to shut off your product that you bought from them than some kind of fly-by-night company. But any service-backed product could die and you would be out of luck. Like that, I have a TiVo, right? If TiVo died, which it probably won't, but you know, if it died and the TiVo service went out, that's just, I'm out of luck. That's the end of the service. I'm
that
done.
That's a lot of faith in TiVo, man.
Well, I don't have faith in TiVo. I feel like they just got bought by Rovi, and that they'll keep them around. Somebody will purchase the assets and keep that around for some period
Rovi
of time.
Rovi said they weren't interested in the hardware, which scared the hell out of me. But they have released a new box, so maybe.
Yeah, and again, I'm paying them a monthly fee, so I feel like there's a revenue stream for somebody to probably do. But the fact is, if somebody wanted to kill that service, all of the hardware they've sold would just be dead. Mark. And that's scary.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, what about this vibrator?
Oh, man.
That's a service. Start and end of that segment right there.
So the Lovence vibrator, which is an internet-connected vibrator. I don't think it relies on a service of any kind, but it does allow you remotely to control it. And apparently, for reasons I don't really understand, and the company says it's a minor software bug, it was recording sound files during its use and storing them on your phone. A Redditor found it.
Sounds like a feature to me.
I mean, that's that. You know, we have an acronym that's Internet of S, and this is right at the top of that list of that one. Because who knows what? I mean, if that was intentionally put in there, or if somebody wasn't paying attention and the supplier used on the circuit board had an exploit put in, and that the circuit board just came with a microphone for no reason. This can just happen with pretty much any device. If it happens to have any type of microphone or other input in it, it's possible. You should pretty much crack open anything, even the slightest bit intimate, and check. I hate to go, you know, whole Edward Snowden paranoid, but if a vibrator is going to that length,
then you're probably
put your vibrator in a Faraday cage.
You're probably not interested in Lovence's. That's the company's other product. I could show you the headline, but I don't dare. You're not going to show it, are you, Karsten?
Oh yeah, the BEDP.
Yeah, forget it. We're not going to talk about it. Not going to talk about it.
This does go under like, do you, I feel like I say this all the time now, but just like the question with any new technological device, like one of the most important questions is, should I connect it to the internet?
There's some things,
you know what I mean?
Just and don't belong like, on the internet.
But companies want so badly to have these monthly recurring users. Like this data point is something that they can sell in one way or another. Maybe they just want to be able to like anonymously say how many people are using this vibrator every month. Just like those sort of practices really matter. You go to conferences and people talk about this stuff really seriously. Metrics. As if they've never had a friend in real life before. It's terrifying.
Maybe not.
But I also think it is worth saying that there are users that want this, right? That there are people who want to remotely control.
I think there's some value to it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I think it's worth saying that on the user side, there is some value to it. There are people that benefit from this sort of thing and use it. And I think, that could be potentially a good thing. But I also think the sex toy industry and not to strangely relate this, but also just the regular toy industry, there is like this huge push to connect everything to the internet. And part of and it's very connected to what Sam is saying, that like they want data. They want sort of monthly active users, if you will. Hopefully it's a weekly active user in this case, at the very least. But But, you know, they want to, I just think you have to be really careful if you're in an industry, if you're a company in an industry that hasn't traditionally connected what you're doing, your devices, the things you're making to the internet, you have to be really careful about how you build this stuff, software and otherwise. And, you know, this is a perfect example of, you know, the mantra of like, should I connect it to the internet? And if so, let's do it very carefully.
In unrelated news, the Tickle You Elmo just got announced.
On that note, I want to wrap this up. Sam, I did want to talk about the Google Pixel Buds. We're out of time. Maybe next time we'll get you back and we can talk about it. You guys at ours got a pair. I don't know how, magically. But they're starting to arrive in people. Oh, look at that. That's pretty.
This is the case, and this is the Bud. Anyone listening, I'm really sorry. I'll do my best with words. The Bud is designed in such a way that there's a smaller black portion that fits in your ear, and then you push. Sorry to hit the mic. This cord you push to like fit the rest of it into your ear canal. I'm pushing it all the way.
Oh, interesting.
But it doesn't, you know, I've only had it for about 24 hours, so I'm not going to say anything definitive. You'll have to tune into ArsTechnica.com later this week for more thoughts.
I want to read your review.
But it's a weird fit because there's no instruction. It just says, put it in your ear and stick this in. But this hard plastic part, if you don't like these sorts of things, like in an Apple AirPod or otherwise, this is not necessarily going to win you over, and you can't adjust this for the size of your general ear canal. And it's hard to tell whether it's supposed to sit in the front or the back. But it's not just that, you know, you're paying $160. It comes with a case that has its own charging in it. Like, it's got a little battery in the case.
So this is Google's response to the Apple AirPods, basically.
And as you notice, it's got the little corded connector between both.
Yeah,
it's got the little wire there. But it's also got a touch-sensitive side on the right ear. Tap to play and pause. Hold it down to talk to it. Just you hold it down and you say a voice command to Google Assistant. And you can do a double tap if you've gotten a notification, and it'll read it out loud to you.
And for people who thought we had not ended the internet-connected vibrator story, we have. This is separate. Don't confuse the two. I'm just saying.
Yes, the video feed is a totally safer word right now. Oh, I just tapped my phone.
Look,
wow.
It worked. I hear they sound very good, but I'll wait for your review.
We'll
I'm curious. Thank you, Sam Moskovich. It's so great to have you on. Tech Culture Editor at Ars Technica, at Sam Red on the Twitter. Regular on our tech news shows, but we're going to get you on the show more because I just enjoy your energy and your wit and your brains.
That is very sweet. I see you cashed my mother's check. Thank you.
I did. Very, very generous of her. It's always nice to have a trust fund. Thank you, Jason Snell, Mac Colors. I'm sorry, sixcolors.com.
Yep.
They're
that's
all,
right, sixcolors.com.
All six of them are there.
I got all, I got all six. I'm, you know, one of these days I'll collect the seventh. Theincomparable.com for my pop culture stuff. And I do a bunch of tech podcasting at relay.fm.
Yes. And all of them must listens. I really enjoy Jason, and we love having you on. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
And again, Ben Johnson, second time on, won't be the last. From Codebreaker, congratulations on the spring. You got yours, I got mine. The Brock Johnson on Twitter, and of course, catch his work on WBUR NPR News in Boston.
Thanks for having me, Leo. I think my mom Venmo'd you. I don't think she mailed a check.
I'll take the Venmo. You, so, that's okay. Yeah. Somebody tried to give me an app because Apple's starting to do this with Apple Pay, send money, but I can't get it. So somebody sent me money, and I couldn't get it. How frustrating!
You just have to use Face ID. That's all. It just needs to understand your face, and then boom, the money.
The money will just come
it's
out.
It's with that Bitcoin. It's with the Bitcoin that got lost
out of the box. Yeah, it's in my wallet somewhere in space. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday, wrapping up the week's tech. The Last Word in Tech is your first podcast of the week, and I hope you will tune in 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC every Sunday afternoon. You can watch us at youtube.com/Twitter. twit.tv/live or on Twitch or on Ustream. And if you do any of that, please join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. We had a great studio audience today. Thank you all for being here from all over the world, from Australia and New York and the Philippines and Oklahoma City. If you want to be in studio, just email me tickets at twit.tv. We'd love to have you visit. Of course, on-demand audio and video of everything we do is available at our website, twit.tv. You could subscribe there. In fact, that's the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Use your favorite podcast application, Pocket Cast, iTunes, Overcast, and get every single episode of audio or video of Twit. We are doing a best of, as always, at the end of the year. It'll be I guess that'll be New Year's Eve. Oh, our New Year's Eve show. If you have some suggestions, a moment that happened this week, I'm sorry, this year on Twit, just go to twit.tv/best of. Fill out the form. You don't have to be complete. Don't worry if you don't know the exact time and so forth. But whatever you can do to help, our editors put together those best of episodes. They're always fun. And your input is much appreciated. Twit.tv/best of. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.